It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
I have the best moveset.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want!
Oh my God, they had the Rizzler throw out the ceremonial first pitch at the Mets game this afternoon against the Blue Jays. Now I've seen it all. The Rizzler in a Mets uniform on the field throwing the first pitch. Now watch, we're going to go on to lose 95 games. This is episode 908 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, April 6th, 2025. I am the Solo Monster. We are 2 weeks out from WrestleMania. We had a lot of newsworthy developments on the WrestleMania front this week that we will get into. Of course, tonight is AEW Dynasty on pay-per-view. I'm going to be talking about that as well. And I've got a Dark Side of the Ring review for you on Ludwig Borga, which is going to be very interesting. So a lot to get into here. Right off the bat, I want to say thank you to everybody who has shown some love and support for me and what I do, this show, and the YouTube channel all week long, including our PayPal producers this week. And if you would like to make a PayPal drop and get your name in lights here, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. I want to say thank you to Big B, Bryant Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton. Paul, I hope you're doing well. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, who was at SmackDown with Mama Eichard on Friday. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar. Killshot Keith Hart, who will be at Dynasty tonight in Philadelphia, so I hope you have a good time. And a happy birthday to Alex, who celebrated his birthday yesterday at the New England Fan Fest. He was walking the floor representing the podcast, rocking his Sound Off shirt. Very cool. Speaking of shirts, Pro Wrestling Tees is having a spring fling sale, which actually kicks off today and it runs through Wednesday. You can get 20% off all Sound Off shirts in our store. No promo code needed. Just make sure you grab the shirts that you want by Wednesday before the sale ends. That's prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. On Tuesday, the Dallas Morning News reported that AEW All In Texas at Globe Life Field in Arlington on July 12th will have a special early start time starting at 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central Time locally. Since then, however, ticket holders were notified that the start time has been changed and it will now be starting at 2 p.m. Eastern, which would be 1 p.m. Central Time locally. Doors open at noon. I know All In has had an earlier start time for the past couple of years. That was due to the time zone difference because those shows were overseas. Here, it just feels like the decision was made to make absolutely sure that they avoided any head-to-head with Saturday night's main event, which is airing on NBC that night. Whatever it is, though, I think it's a great idea. I love the fact that they have these All In shows earlier in the afternoon, as long as these AEW shows can be. I have no issue with that. AEW is also holding live episodes of Dynamite and Collision at the Curtis Colwell Center in Garland, Texas, Wednesday, July 9th, Thursday, July 10th. And on Friday, July 11th, Ring of Honor returns to the Esports Stadium in Arlington for Death Before Dishonor. That'll be the second year in a row for the show in that venue. So they have their own, you know, WWE does this where they have their own block of like three or four straight days of events. And so this is sort of like their own little takeover that week in Texas. Now, I'm going to get into Dynasty here in a few minutes, but I want to address this story first. There was a report this week on SEScoops.com that got a lot of people talking. And at the start of the year, you know, AEW, they started simulcasting Dynamite and Collision on the Max streaming service. And no numbers have been released as to how the show is doing on there, outside of comments from Tony Khan that, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery is happy with how AEW is performing. Beyond that, we don't have any actual numbers because they don't release the numbers. They're not accessible in the same way that Nielsen numbers are for cable TV. But then a reporter named BJ Bethel, who also reported on AEW's media rights deal being finished before it was officially announced, even though there were conflicting reports about whether or not it was actually a done deal at that point, but he said it was. He posted this report on Monday. All Elite Wrestling is averaging around 500,000 viewers for its Wednesday Dynamite show on the Max streaming platform since the show debuted on the app this year, according to sources. Combined with live cable numbers, this would give Dynamite an average of around 1 to 1.2 million viewers per episode since it was added to the streaming service. According to sources, the show is averaging around 60 million minutes watched per show, with a deviation of plus or minus 10 to 20% depending on the episode and competition. The minutes watched averages to 500,000 viewers per episode live plus one, meaning it takes into account viewers who watch live on the app and for 24 hours afterward. Sources said AEW has regularly outperformed some major hockey games on the app. NBA games on Max average around 1.7 to 2 million viewers depending on matchups and competition, while AEW's success on streaming has been noted by the Warner Brothers Discovery executives, the numbers are far from top streaming programs like Daredevil, Born Again, and Agatha All Along, which brings in numbers from 7 to 10 million per episode. A source who corroborated the numbers said he expected AEW to face stronger competition through the spring, with the Andor Star Wars series resuming in April and WWE entering WrestleMania season. Many of the top execs don't know the overall numbers, the source said. Whether it's total minutes watched, viewers who have watched the total show, they can make correlations, but what streamers look for is quite different from cable or OTA, where numbers are there to satisfy advertisers. And ever since this report was published, it has been a fucking war zone on social media. And I just find this entire thing to be completely silly. Once they began simulcasting on Max, all the ratings discourse around AEW became completely irrelevant, which is why I don't even talk about the weekly numbers anymore. Because there is no longer an accurate way to know for sure how many people are watching these shows week to week. And I'm one of those Max viewers, by the way. I watch Dynamite on Max every week because I just like it better, and I don't get a lot of the usual commercials. I actually think the audio and video quality is better. Although, if the show is not live, it's a bitch finding it on there. You know, when it's live, I have to scroll down a little bit, but it's usually there. Otherwise, I got to go into the search box, I got to type it in. But all that being said, do I believe that there are 500,000 weekly viewers, that they are averaging 500,000 weekly viewers on Max, or anywhere close to that? Absolutely not. I do not. I mean, what would that be? That would be what, 85 to 90% of the audience they get on TBS? That would be incredible if they did that. But then even BJ Bethel later admitted to Dave Meltzer that the 500,000 number, it could be total viewers having tuned in for even just a few minutes. Yeah, I find it very hard to believe that in the absence of any real data, outside of someone at Warner Brothers, you know, saying, trust us, that the numbers are that high. Like, even the NBA numbers that he cites in his report, like up to 2 million per game on Max, depending on the game. There was a story in the Sports Business Journal only a couple of months ago that NBA viewership is actually down 5% across broadcast and cable TV. And so the idea that they're doing another 2 million on Max, it doesn't make sense to me. You know, Bethel claims that he has two main sources for this. Obviously, he's not going to reveal who they are. No journalist would. But in the absence of hard numbers coming directly from Warner, and even then, I mean, you'd have to trust Warner Brothers Discovery that the numbers are real. You know, self-reporting is not exactly the most trustworthy form of reporting. I'm looking at you, WWE. All these gate records they claim to be breaking every other month. I mean, I can believe it when you look at their attendance and you look at what they're charging for tickets these days. But still, all we have to really go on is their word that they're setting new gate records every month with their shows, right? Because they don't report those numbers like they used to before the merger. So in the absence of any kind of independent measurement body, you know, specifically for streaming, which either doesn't exist right now or doesn't have access to the actual numbers, these numbers don't hold any real weight. And I'm not even saying he's pulling them out of his ass. It's entirely possible this is what he was told by somebody there. But that doesn't make it true. you know, Brandon Thurston of WrestleNomics, he actually got an on-the-record comment, quote-unquote comment here from Warner Brothers Discovery, which was not much of one, but they said they can't comment on any actual viewership information for Max, but that Max has never released that information either on or off the record. You know, when it was just the Nielsen numbers, the numbers would be reported for all the world to see. With streaming numbers, you see what they want you to see, if you see anything at all. There is no singular metric that exists or, you know, system in place for streaming that exists akin to Nielsen. It's very hard to get streaming numbers or know that, you know, how they're even calculating the numbers that they do share. They may share them for sporting events like, you know, NFL games or for some of their biggest shows. You know, they put out numbers for The Penguin when it first came out, but those were cross-platform numbers, including HBO and Max. I don't think they broke it out by Max only. If Warner Brothers Discovery wanted to do the same thing for AEW, there's nothing stopping them. They could put out cross-platform numbers, but they choose not to do so. So all we're left with are guesses, you know, outside of the weekly Nielsen numbers, which are generally in the 500,000 to 700,000 range. You know, last week, Dynamite did its best viewership since January. They averaged 663,000 viewers on TBS. This week, they were down to 594,000. Those are the numbers that we know of. And since they're incomplete and they don't count streaming, they give us an incomplete snapshot, and I don't bother with them anymore. Tony Khan was asked about the Max report by John Alba on Thursday's Dynasty Media Call, and Tony said even he doesn't get weekly numbers from Warner Brothers Discovery, as far as how the show does. But they've told him that AEW is among the top streamers when it comes to sports-centric programming. And his understanding is that it's one of their top streaming shows, even though it's never ranked in the top 10 on their streaming charts. Like Monday Night Raw, for example, right? They usually rank in the top 10 of all shows in the U.S. Like if you look at the Netflix main page, I can't ever remember seeing AEW in the top 10 on the Max page. You know, I mean, Netflix in the U.S. has around 90 million users across the U.S. and Canada. I don't know what the number is for Max, but it's not nearly as many. I mean, the last number I saw was globally. They had a little over 100 million subscribers, and in the U.S. it was around 40 million, you know, but that was a couple of years ago now. So for the people discrediting the report, I mean, if you don't believe the report, that's fine. I don't either. But to discredit it solely because Tony Khan isn't shouting from the highest rooftop every week that they're pulling 500,000 viewers on Max, even Tony himself doesn't know what the numbers are. And even if he did, they're not for him to share. It's not his call to release them. They keep that shit close to the vest because they don't want it out there. So him not tweeting about it doesn't mean anything. It has no bearing on whether the report is true or not. You know, why don't these streaming services release their numbers? Because their numbers are not as good as they want people to think they are. That's why. And it works to their advantage when they're negotiating deals for new shows, or if they're renegotiating existing shows. Right, it's better if the folks making those shows don't know that their numbers are super strong, because then they'll want more money. They keep those numbers a secret for financial reasons as much as anything else. I know that was a big sticking point during the writer's strike a couple of years ago. They advocated for greater transparency with streaming numbers. And clearly that hasn't changed much since then, and it really should. But in the end, the only thing that really matters is whether Warner Brothers Discovery is happy with how AEW is performing. And clearly they are. So for everyone getting hung up on the specific numbers, you're just wasting oxygen. You know, there are signs of life when it comes to their attendance, but not so much that, you know, you could reasonably read that report and think to yourself, yeah, I can believe that. Look at their attendance numbers. You know, they're up across the board. They're not. But they do good numbers for their pay-per-views. I mean, it looks like they're headed for around 7,000 tonight in Philly, which is more than they did for last year's show in a building of a similar size. Revolution last month had over 11,000 fans in the building, which actually makes it the second highest attended Revolution they've ever done, only behind Sting's retirement match last year. I'd like to see them doing better for their Texas show. They've only got 12,000 tickets out for the stadium in Arlington, but you know they still have 3 months to go, and not a single match has been announced yet. So they'll get there. I think they're a lock for at least 20K for that show. But the weekly attendance figures, they're not what they used to be. They're still running out of smaller venues. And if there were 500,000 more people watching that show every single week, it's not unreasonable to expect that you would see that reflected in their attendance, and you're really not seeing that. Tony also said on that media call, by the way, that he saw Sting last month, and the topic of inducting Lex Luger into the WWE Hall of Fame never came up, and it still hasn't. So it sounds like Sting hasn't even bothered asking him yet. He may not want to after that billionaire's kid line that John Cena dropped on Monday night. The injury bug has bitten AEW with Switchblade Jay White, Orange Cassidy, and Mark Davis all injured. Jay White had declared for the Owen Hart Foundation tournament many weeks ago, and when they came on the air for Dynamite on Wednesday, Excalibur said that he was attacked in the back by the Death Riders, and therefore he would not be able to compete in the Owen, and they had to reset the brackets as a result. And I'll get into those brackets in a moment. So not only is he out of the Owen, but he's going to be off TV for a while because per Fightful, it is a legitimate injury. AEW, up until last night, on Wednesday, they didn't address what the injury was. Jay White actually appeared on Collision last night, and his arm was all wrapped up, and they confirmed that it is a hand injury. Dave Meltzer reported that he heard the injury was a broken hand, and so that was confirmed last night. And, you know, surgery and going to be out for a while. So that sucks. He got hurt in the Owen last year and he missed 3 months. I think it was a foot injury. Foot, hand. Let's hope he doesn't get popped in the mouth next. So Jay White is out. Orange Cassidy has not been seen on television since the four-way match to crown a number one contender to Kenny Omega's international title tonight. Fightful is reporting that he is out with what is believed, not confirmed, but believed to be a torn pec muscle. No word on whether it's a full tear or a partial tear, because that will dictate how long he'll be out for, obviously. If it's a full tear, you're probably looking at 8 to 9 months. It looks like it happened on the Tilt-A-Whirl spot in that four-way match with Ricochet and Speedball Mike Bailey and Mark Davis. And it didn't look like anything out of the ordinary, but after that move, he grabbed at his arm. And he was favoring it for the rest of the match, but he finished the match, which is why I didn't think anything of it. Even though Taz spotted it right away, and on commentary, Taz is talking about, oh, he may have torn his bicep. So he noticed something was wrong right away. Turns out it was his pec. And Mark Davis, in that recent match that he had on Dynamite with Powerhouse Hobbs, they had a very brief match. Turns out it was very brief because Davis got hurt, and they probably called an early end to it. There was a chop spot in the corner about a minute in, after which Davis started moving around very funny. And according to Meltzer, he fractured his foot and is expected to be out for a few months, but may be kept on television with the Don Callis family. So he may not completely disappear from TV. It feels like he spent more time on the injured list than he has in the ring since signing with AEW. You know, he missed over a year with a broken wrist, and only recently it felt like he was finding a role for himself, now that Aussie Open is finished. And Kyle Fletcher is obviously being groomed for much bigger things than just being in a tag team for the rest of his career. But now he gets hurt again. You know, this is where having the kind of depth that AEW has on its roster is an advantage. You know, when people go down, if they do have to be off TV for any length of time, they have plenty of other names who can pick up the slack. Now, the Owen Hart tournament brackets were revealed on Dynamite. The finals on the men's and women's side are going to take place at Double or Nothing on May 25th, so they will not be taking place in Calgary this year. On the men's side, the first round matches look like this. Will Ospreay, one-on-one with Kevin Knight. Brody King against Konosuke Takeshita. Mark Briscoe against Kyle Fletcher. And Hangman Adam Page will face a wild card entrant. So with Jay White's injury, he was bumped from the tournament and replaced by Kevin Knight, who just signed with the company, and he wrestled Jay White on Collision last week. He also had interest, and he had a standing tryout with WWE at the Performance Center. I don't know if he took them up on the tryout or not, but he opted to sign with AEW instead. So he gets the match with Will Ospreay, with the original plan being Ospreay against Jay White. Ospreay, Takeshita, and Hangman. Those are the big names in here. Jay White would have been, but again, he got hurt. And then you have the wild card, who really should be MJF. And I don't know if it will be or not, but it should be MJF, because it just makes absolutely no sense why MJF would not declare himself for the tournament like Hangman did. I mean, it was the same thing last year. Maybe MJF really doesn't want to win the belt back, even though he says he does. His words and his actions, they don't match up. You know, Josh Alexander, he also still has not debuted anywhere. It could be him. You know, he left TNA and around the same time, I think, maybe a little after. Speedball actually left in November, but Alexander's contract expired in February. So not quite the same time, but Speedball Mike Bailey and Josh Alexander, they both left TNA. Speedball's already on TV. And the last word on Alexander was that he was coming to AEW. We just haven't heard anything else since. So if it's not MJF, I could see it being a way for them to introduce him, even though I can't see him beating Hangman. I tell you one thing, it will not be Darby Allin, because he is scheduled to start his Mount Everest climb next Tuesday, and that could take up to 2 months. But looking at the bracket, I think Hangman advances, whoever the wild card is, Hangman advances. So do they want Hangman to beat MJF a second time? I don't know. Mark Briscoe is in there to lose. We get Hangman against Kyle Fletcher in the semifinals, with Hangman moving on to the finals. Because why put Fletcher in the finals just to lose to Will Ospreay again? And on the other side, Ospreay beats Kevin Knight, and Konosuke Takeshita beats Brody King, who's also in there just to lose. So we get a rematch from Revolution last year. Ospreay one-on-one with Takeshita. That was a fucking great match. And I think we have Ospreay going to the finals. Look, the way I look at it, this is Ospreay's to lose right now. But Hangman could win this too. It's one of those two. Especially after the angle they did at the end of Dynamite, where Swerve Strickland was searching for Jon Moxley. And Hangman Page showed up and started screaming that, "I promised you, you would never hold that world championship again." And Swerve told him, "Let it go, bro. Let it go." And Hangman said, "You broke into my house." And Swerve said, "You burned down my house." And Hangman screamed, "You deserved it." And Swerve said, "I know." And that was not what Hangman was expecting. That caught him off guard, and he asked him to repeat what he just said, and Swerve said, "I know." Which is the first time that he has conceded that he got what he deserved. And Hangman didn't know how to react to this, so he just stormed off. I love that. I was far more interested in that little piece of story development than I was anything they did with Swerve and Moxley. But it also potentially sets up, you know, one more Swerve Hangman match for All In. Now, on the women's side, the Owen Hart tournament first round matches look like this. Jamie Hayter, one-on-one with Billy Starks. Thunder Rosa against Chris Statlander. Mercedes Moné against Julia Hart. And Athena against Harley Cameron. This looks like Jamie Hayter's tournament to lose. It's about time they heat her back up again. And there's still time to do it in time for Texas. You know, she beats Billy. She goes on to challenge Statlander in the next round. On the other side of the bracket, we've got Mercedes in one match and Athena in the other. And what I've been saying is that they meet in the tournament and they wrestle to a time limit draw. So neither woman loses. Neither woman wins, but neither woman loses against the other. And then from there, they can wrestle at Super Card of Honor on May 2nd or, yeah, more likely Double or Nothing. Obviously, that's a much bigger show. And then have the third and final match in Texas at All In, with Athena winning the TBS title. I know some people think I'm absolutely crazy, and they think, well, Mercedes is just going to beat her, and she's going to win everything. She's going to win the Owen, she's going to beat Athena, she's going to wrestle Toni Storm, and it's going to be champion against champion, and it's just the way it's going to be. Or they're going to take it all the way to October with Mercedes, just so she can beat Jade Cargill's record as the longest reigning TBS champion of all time. Because to do that, that's what she would have to do. She would have to hold on to that title until October. And I think that these people are being overly paranoid. And I'll tell you what, if that happens, I will be the first one in line to call them out for it and say I was wrong and call them out for it, because that would be awful. This is tailor-made for an Athena win in Texas. But if they draw in the semifinals, that would mean that Hayter against Statlander would go from a semifinal match to the last match in the tournament. I don't know if they're going to do that. I don't see why not. Because otherwise, if they're going to have one beat the other, Mercedes would be the one going to the finals with Jamie Hayter winning. And if Jamie Hayter beats Mercedes in the finals, and becomes the first woman to pin Mercedes, then why even bother with Mercedes against Athena, right? The story then would be Jamie challenging Mercedes for the TBS title. Why even have her go after the world championship when she just got this first pinfall win over the TBS champion, the unbeatable TBS champion? That would be the match to do, would it not? That's why I say let them draw, have Hayter against Statlander with Jamie winning, and challenging Toni Storm for the women's world title in Arlington. There's history there. When Jamie Hayter lost the AEW women's title 2 years ago, it was to Toni Storm. Toni Storm was the one who took it from her. So there's already history there to build on. But here's the updated card for Dynasty tonight with my quick predictions for each. We have some new matches added. On the 0 Hour pre-show, they have added Nick Wayne teaming with Action Andretti and Leo Rush against AR Fox and Top Flight. And I've got Wayne's team winning this. When was the last time AR Fox won anything? Exactly. Nick Wayne, by the way, he was also announced for this year's New Japan Best of the Super Juniors tournament, which kicks off on May 10th, and that'll be his debut in that tournament. Also on the 0 Hour, Max Caster will have another one of his comedy open challenges, which should be answered by a returning Anthony Bowens, because I think this gimmick has played itself out. I see some people saying Josh Alexander. It's on the fucking 0 Hour. Like, let's calm down. Okay, let's not have Josh Alexander, all right, please, coming out and debuting on the 0 Hour. We have two Owen Hart tournament first round matches. Will Ospreay against Kevin Knight, that'll be a win for Ospreay. And the former TBS champion Julia Hart challenges the current TBS champion Mercedes Moné, which will be a win for Mercedes. The Hurt Syndicate defend the AEW tag team titles against Big Bill and Brian Keith of the Learning Tree. That'll be a win for Lashley and Shelton Benjamin. Chris Jericho issued the challenge a few weeks ago to a title versus mask match for the Ring of Honor World Championship against Bandido. Where are the people who said that putting the title on Jericho is to help them get a TV deal for Ring of Honor? Where's that TV deal? I still don't see a TV deal. This should be a win for Bandido. Probably not the last time we'll see them matched up. They have that pay-per-view coming up. You know, they have Supercard of Honor on May 2nd. We'll probably get a rematch there. Jericho will lose that one too. Daniel Garcia defends the TNT Championship against Adam Cole. Now, these two have already had two matches so far this month, or actually last month. The first one went to a no contest. Their last one went to a time limit draw. So this time, it is no time limit and no interference allowed. And I'm going to go with Adam Cole here to win the title strictly because I think we need a new champion crown. I think Daniel Garcia, you know, look, God bless him. He's a babyface who's better off in chase mode. His reign here has been very lackluster. And I think Adam Cole winning the championship, and even if they have Garcia chase to get it back, I mean, that's fine. But I think this needs a shakeup, and I think Cole wins the title. The Death Riders defend the AEW Trios titles against Adam Copeland and FTR. Cope Hogan, he got another win on Wednesday, this time over Claudio Castagnoli, which between that and all of the trouble that has been brewing within rated FTR, doesn't bode well for a babyface win here, I don't think. The Death Riders are going to retain. The question is, will FTR go heel on Copeland? They're not splitting up FTR. That would be insanely stupid because they're dead in the water if they do that. So FTR goes heel, or I floated this the other night on the stream. What if Copeland, maybe not tonight, but what if Copeland ultimately is the one who goes heel in this, right? I mean, he's been a fucking bore as a babyface. A heel turn could be just what he needs. And it makes it a little more palatable to think that he and Christian Cage can end up back on the same side together. And that's how we get Cope and Christian against FTR in Texas at All In, but with Cope and Christian as the heels. I like that idea. Kenny Omega defends the AEW International title against Ricochet and Speedball Mike Bailey. I got Omega retaining, probably pinning Ricochet to do so. Timeless Toni Storm defends the AEW Women's World Championship against the undefeated Megan Bain. They have done all they can over these last couple of months to build up Megan Bain as a legitimate threat to Toni and that title. They have done all they can. The only question now is, do they go all the way with her? Or do they keep her strong in defeat? That's what I think they do here. They keep her strong in defeat. Because I think Tony is going into Texas with that title. It will be Tony Storm defending that championship against whoever wins the Owen Hart tournament. It will not be Megan Bain. And I don't see them doing a quick, short reign with her. Just do what you can to protect her in defeat. The analogy I used the other night was the first Undertaker and Kane match at WrestleMania. Undertaker beat Kane when they finally met, but it took three Tombstone pile drivers to do so. So if they follow a similar blueprint, like there are ways that they can keep Megan Bain looking strong even if she loses tonight. I hope that's what they do, but I don't see Toni Storm leaving without that title. I'll tell you who should leave Philadelphia without their title. That is Jon Moxley, who defends the AEW World Championship in the main event against Swerve Strickland. 1 year to the very event where Swerve won his first AEW World title. And on Wednesday, Swerve teamed with Willow Nightingale in a win over Jon Moxley and Marina Shafir. But then Moxley laid out Willow with a paradigm shift. And at the end of the show, the Death Riders left Swerve laying in a pile of glass. But then he rose up like the Undertaker, and he smiled at Jon Moxley, who was in the crowd, and that's how they went off the air. So now, not only does Swerve have one reason to beat Jon Moxley, which is to save all of us and take that title away from the Death Riders, he's got two reasons, the other one being to get revenge for what he did to Willow. Then you throw in Hangman Page in the mix. And what they did on Wednesday, that little interaction between them in the back, I think it plays into the finish of this match. And if they do this, it would be so perfect. Hangman comes out, and he tries to stop Swerve from winning the title, like he promised that he would do. I will make sure that you never again hold the AEW World Championship. But then he has second thoughts. After what Swerve said on Wednesday, he has second thoughts. Because Swerve admitted, you know what? I got what I deserved. I deserved what you did to me. So he's having second thoughts all of a sudden, and in the end, he doesn't stand in Swerve's way. He may even help Swerve by fighting off the Death Riders. You know that little shit, Wheeler Yuta, is going to get involved again, right? Hangman will take care of that. Crowd goes wild for it, and Swerve wakes us all up from this nightmare that we have been in and regains the AEW World Championship. That is how you close out Dynasty tonight. And hell hath no fury like a pissed off podcaster if you make me stay up until midnight watching this fucking show and give me an ending like the one you gave me at Revolution. I hope that is not the case, and I will be live no matter what after it's over to discuss it on the post show later tonight. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Picture it. Monday Night Raw is in town, and you're driving to the show when you suddenly get rear-ended. And while it may be the other guy's fault, you're the idiot driving around without any car insurance. It doesn't matter how great of a driver you think you are. With all the crazy people on the road these days, why would you even take the risk? That's what going online is like without ExpressVPN. You need a VPN because every time you connect to a network that's not encrypted, which could be anywhere outside your own home, your online data is not secure. Any hackers on that same network can easily gain access to your personal information and steal your passwords, your bank logins, you name it. It's all right there for the taking. And it doesn't take a lot of know-how to pull it off either. A kid in middle school could do it. Hackers can make a killing on your data, up to $1,000 per person selling it on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from doing so by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. ExpressVPN is the best VPN because it's super secure and it's easy to use. Fire up the app, you click one button to get protected, and that's it. It also works on all of your devices, including phones, laptops, and tablets. And for customers in the United States, ExpressVPN comes with Identity Defender, a new suite of tools to get your data removed from data brokers, alert you when your data is compromised on the dark web, and even insure you against data theft for up to $1 million. There's a reason why ExpressVPN is ranked number one by top tech reviewers like CNET and The Verge. I'm going to be flying out to different places over the next few months, and I'll be doing what I do on every trip that I take, which is making sure that I have ExpressVPN enabled on my phone. That way I've got peace of mind knowing that I'm protected at all times. At the airport, in my hotel, it doesn't matter. It's that important to me. It's just not worth it to risk my credit card details or email passwords and all the things that would be a gigantic pain in the neck to have to change, let alone run the risk of having that information compromised. Now you don't have to worry about it. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster to find out how you can get up to 4 extra months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. Rey Fénix made his WWE debut on SmackDown Friday night. Aleister Black is on his way back soon. Ricky Starks, now Ricky Saints, just won his first championship in WWE on NXT Tuesday night, beating Shawn Spears to become the new North American champion. That leaves one name left who got his early release from AEW, and that is Miro. And now we know, per PW Insider, that it is about to be Rusev Day once again in WWE. PW Insider confirmed with multiple sources that Rusev was at WWE headquarters in Stamford all day Wednesday. According to those that they have spoken with, Rusev has signed with the company, and he was there to have meetings with different officials and took part in a photo shoot in preparation for his return. The last match that he had in AEW was at World's End 2 years ago, and even since then, he's had one independent match. I think it was in Qatar a few months ago. That's it. And funny enough, the last time he had a match with anybody in AEW was against Andrade. That was also Andrade's last match in AEW. And it may not be much longer before we get to see it again. Only this time in a WWE ring. But out of all those names, Aleister Black is the one who I think has the most main event potential. It all comes down to the creative and if he can stay healthy. But if the stars align and all of those things work out, when I look at this list of names, look, I think the world of Ricky Starks, but if I had to pick one name on this list who I think has a real shot, the best shot, at becoming a real headline attraction in WWE, it's Black. And nothing specifically has been said about him by name, but we are still seeing these spooky, smoky vignettes, mainly on SmackDown, teasing someone coming in. It's almost certainly him. The only question is, when is it going to happen? It could be that Friday after WrestleMania, but it's pretty clear he's coming in soon as well. Now, let's take it back to Monday before we get into all the stuff on SmackDown, because SmackDown was really the more newsworthy of the two shows this week. But let's go back to Monday because we had, and this was newsworthy on its own, an actual interaction between John Cena and Cody Rhodes, something we have not seen up to this point. In this supposed feud, I say supposed because the real feud has been between John Cena and the fans, but of course the WrestleMania match is between John Cena and Cody Rhodes. So it was nice to finally, after a fucking month, get a real interaction between these two. And they were dropping bombs on each other and you know, insulting each other and going back and forth. It certainly wasn't a love fest between these two. But it was John Cena pointing out the fact that he and Cody, many, many years ago, were traveling partners. And Cena called Cody his chauffeur and said that he wouldn't protect him because Cody has been protected long enough. You know, funny enough, I did a show this week for Poison Rana, and they've been doing a series where they're covering each of John Cena's 16 title runs in preparation for his retirement this year. So they brought me in for an episode on his shortest run, which I was very grateful for. Literally won the Elimination Chamber in 2010. Sheamus was the champion. Cena wins the chamber. He becomes WWE champion. Vince McMahon comes out, brings out Hollywood Dave Bautista. I guess he wasn't quite Hollywood for a few more weeks, but brings out Dave Bautista. Bautista beats Cena in 30 seconds and wins the title. So it was a very short reign. But I was watching some of the segments in preparation for the show before we did it, and it was an Elimination Chamber qualifying match. It was John Cena against Cody Rhodes on Monday Night Raw, and so it was very jarring to go back and watch that, considering that we are now headed into a WrestleMania main event with John Cena as a heel and a very different Cody Rhodes, obviously, than the one we saw back then when he was still part of Legacy with Randy Orton and Ted DiBiase Jr. And I hope that, you know, in that final video package or some video package they put together for this match, that they point out the fact that these two have history together. They have worked together before. Maybe just throw in some quick highlights of them from back then in 2010, and now we see them today, and here we are 15 years later. So, yeah, I just watched that the other day, and apparently at the time they were traveling partners. And Cena said that he was always accused of burying talent, but he was the talent. I don't bury talent. I am the talent. The only thing he ever buried, he said, was mediocrity. You hear that, Nexus? You hear that, Dolph Ziggler? You hear that, Alex Riley? He said Cody manipulated his way to the top. His ego outmatched his ability, and he rode the coattails of Cena's success. He said Cody rode with him and stole all of his secrets, but he failed because Cena told him you always have to be authentic. Otherwise, the fans can see right through you as phony. But Cody didn't listen to him. He was too perfect. He was too rehearsed. And he said he worked too hard to make the championship a symbol of mastery, only to be okay with having a paint-by-numbers Nepo baby holding that title. So then Cody said that, yeah, he was chosen, like Cena said, but he was chosen by the people. And John Cena couldn't say the same thing. He said Cena was chosen by one guy in an office who isn't here anymore, and we can't talk about him. He said Cena was a company creation, and when referring to taking public speaking classes at the age of 16, that Cena hangs out with Zac Efron and wishes he was 16, because that was another criticism that Cena had for him. You know, you sound like you're a 16-year-old taking public speaking classes. So he threw it back at his face. But the key line for me was when Cody brought up that Cena created so many disenfranchised fans that it made it easy for him to leave and go somewhere else. And that Cena shouldn't act like he left this company better than he found it. And oh, by the way, who was the one who sold out to The Rock? Which was the first time The Rock has even been alluded to, the first time his name has even been mentioned in a month since Elimination Chamber. But it was that line about Cena creating so many disenfranchised fans. And really, it was Vince McMahon who created those fans by pushing Cena so hard for so long, probably at the expense of others. But there were a lot of people. That's a shoot. There were a lot of people, a lot of fans, some friends of mine who were fans during that period who, this is when Cena was on top, like Super Cena and in the years that followed, who just stopped watching. And they lost interest in the product because it just wasn't fun for them anymore. They were sick and tired of it. And so, yes, there were many fans who were disenfranchised who dropped off during that period. Cena said he worked 100 times harder than Cody did and was never protected from the fans. He said he always made things great, no matter what garbage they gave him, which is a fucking lie. He said Cody had to leave because his best couldn't wipe Cena's ass. And he said, Cena made empires. I made empires for billionaires, while Cody only stole money from their kids. Which was a dig at Tony Khan that I think most people got, although it may have gone over some people's heads initially. It was actually a great line. It was a great burn. And he said, Cody did that. The one thing between the two of them that never once the fans chanted at him was, you can't wrestle. So this was like basically a roast, a giant roast back and forth, drawing a little bit on their history together, you know, Cena bringing up the fact they used to ride together, Cody throwing it right back at his face. And I said at the beginning of all this, you know, I was really looking forward to a back and forth promo battle to see how Cody would respond and how Cody would come off here, because John Cena, we have seen him do this before. He did it to Roman Reigns a number of years ago, where he can just bury you and overwhelm you on the microphone if he really wants to and tear you down. Did the same thing with Austin Theory a few years ago. Theory had no response. He really didn't. He hasn't been the same since. Even though he beat Cena at WrestleMania, he has not been the same since. Would Cody be able to match him wit for wit, line for line, blow by blow? I thought he did a very good job on Monday night. I might even give him the edge, frankly, because my expectations were not all that high, frankly. And I thought that he did perfectly fine. Maybe Cena held back a little bit, but Cena threw a lot at him. And when the segment was over, I just sat here going, okay, this is more like it. This is what I was hoping to see after the heel turn. But they waited an entire month to give it to us. And now John Cena is not scheduled for any more appearances on TV before WrestleMania. My hope is that he'll pop up as a surprise, because when this segment was over, he was laying on the ground looking up. Actually, he wasn't looking up at anything because his eyes were closed like he was dead. He took one crossroads and laid there like he was unconscious. And that's how they ended it. Now, this was the beginning of the show, the opening segment of the show in London on Monday. I thought that by the end of the night, we might have a segment in the back where Cena would get his revenge and he would leave Cody laying, but they didn't do that. They let Cody stand tall at the end of this segment. Now, Cena told People magazine this week, when he was asked about, you know, the build to WrestleMania here, he said there's more unpredictability on the way. I certainly hope so. He is not scheduled for any more appearances. It would be nice if he showed up this week or next week, unannounced, as a surprise, and maybe then he'll get his revenge on Cody. Maybe this time he'll be the one leaving Cody laying. I just think that if he doesn't show up at all for the next 2 weeks, there's going to be a real hole here that they're going to have to fill. And the way they'll fill it is having Cody cut promos, I guess, unless they're going to have The Rock finally show up. Then it's all on Cody's shoulders to just talk and cut promos, where they could air video packages, I guess. But I'm just hoping that this is not the last that we get from these two before WrestleMania. But it was good that they finally put the focus on Cena and Cody and not just Cena and the fans. You know, we had references to Vince McMahon and Tony Khan in this promo. There's actually been a lot of subtle AEW references, and maybe not so subtle ones, recently on WWE programming. Like, that we had the billionaires line on that show in the promo. Cody talking also about how he got booed out of the company that he created. That was another thing he mentioned on Monday. CM Punk a few weeks ago, how I work with children. Drew McIntyre last week on SmackDown, when he got chokeslammed on the windshield of the car by Damian Priest. He got glass in his eye. The real glass. You see CM Punk comes walking by as McIntyre is laying there on top of the car. He goes, that's a shame. And he keeps on walking. There's been a lot of different references. Even with Sean Spears and Ricky Starks last week in their promo. There was a mention about how you burn bridges. If things don't work out here for you, you can't really go back to where you came from. Although I don't think Ricky has any interest in going back to where he came from. I think he's quite content to make this work. Then we had Gunther against Jimmy Uso. And for all the people raving about the Cody Rhodes and John Cena segment from Monday night, this here, I thought was even better. This was my favorite segment, the best segment on Raw Monday night, even above Cena and Cody at the beginning of the show. And this, what this was just old school, very basic, but very effective pro wrestling. And this is exactly what the story needed. And I've been saying it for weeks. Gunther has to make this personal. He has to go after his family. He's got to go after Jimmy Uso. They made the match. They did the match. The match was nothing special. And it looked like they might just keep it to him putting him in a sleeper. And here comes Jey Uso down to the ring, and he chases off Gunther into the crowd. And I'm like, man, this, what a drop ball if this is where it ends, right? Because then they went to commercial. But when they came back from commercial, that's where business picked up. And Jey was helping Jimmy away from the ring. Gunther now comes back through the crowd, and he attacks them from behind. And it ended here with him zip tying one of Jey's wrists to the rope. And he just continued to brutalize Jimmy in the ring, power bombed him. He hit him in the head with the belt. And so, you know, he did a blade job. When he got back up on the apron, Jimmy's pouring blood. Now he's power bombing this guy. Blood is everywhere. There's blood on the mat. There's blood all over Gunther. He locks him in a sleeper hold again, just out of reach of Jey's, because Jey is reaching and he's trying to grab his brother, but he can't. And just out of his reach, Gunther's got him locked in the sleeper hold. And I mean, there is blood everywhere. Gunther looked like an absolute psychopath, just bathed in Jimmy's blood and looking up at laughing in Jey's face. Calling him a big pussy. Come on, you big pussy. Come do something about it. Like, I'm watching this and I'm going, where has this been? Like, very old school pro wrestling angle here. You go after the family member. It's like something out of a Rocky movie. But it works. Now, the follow-up, of course, has to be that we see a different side of Jey Uso. We hear a different side from Jey Uso. Not the Yeet Man. This has to be a more serious Jey Uso. When we see him on the show tomorrow night, if we get the same Jey Uso we got a month ago coming out and yeeting, then this was a fucking waste. The key is in the follow-up here, but what they did here was fantastic. And exactly what this feud needed to really jumpstart it and give it some new life. So I love this angle. And then in the main event, they had Rhea Ripley challenging Io Sky in a rematch for the Women's World Championship. Bianca Belair, special referee. Gee, I wonder what will happen. I wonder if we'll get some drama here and if we'll have some officiating issues with Bianca. Well, we did, because she accidentally got bumped multiple times, in fact. So much so that she got sick and tired of it and she threw the entire match away. And then all the women were fighting at the end of the show. And Rhea Ripley was the one posing with the Women's World Championship when it was over, even though she is not in the match at WrestleMania. As of this moment, she is not in the match at WrestleMania. That will all change on Raw tomorrow night. And there's actually two different ways they could go with this. The basic way, and the way I think they'll go, is that they'll make it a triple threat match. And Rhea Ripley actually has a reason now to ask Adam Pearce to do the right thing and insert her into this match at WrestleMania, because she had a visual pin on Io Sky during this match last Monday. While Bianca Belair, she got accidentally booted. She was on the outside licking her wounds. And Rhea Ripley is covering the champion for like a 10 or a 12 count. All she has to do is go to Adam Pearce and go, look, I had that match won. I should be the champion right now. This is not fair. And I should be added to the match, make it a triple threat. The other thing they could do is, because they have two nights to play with, and they're not doing this with the main event angle, so what they could do is they could say, you know what? It would be unfair to Bianca if we added anybody else to this match, because she earned the right to challenge the champion at WrestleMania. She won the Elimination Chamber. So on WrestleMania Night 1, it will be Bianca Belair against Io Sky. The winner of that match will then defend the championship against Rhea Ripley on Night 2. And they could spread it out over the course of two nights. And I'm actually fine with it either way. My guess is, though, they go the path of least resistance here, the predictable way, which is to make it a triple threat match. So we'll have yet another triple threat match on this show. But we all know Rhea Ripley is getting a shot at the title of WrestleMania. Whether it comes in a triple threat or a singles match on night two, we know where this is headed. And I suspect that they will get that all confirmed on Raw tomorrow. And I don't think they're going to drag this out until next week. We'll know tomorrow for sure what they're doing. SmackDown was actually the more newsworthy of the two shows, and it had big implications for WrestleMania. The biggest thing being CM Punk finally revealing to the world what the favor is that he was owed from Paul Heyman. Was it long-term storytelling? Absolutely. Was it an underwhelming use of the favor after such a long buildup? Yeah. Yeah, it was. But you know what? Outside of them making this a number one contenders match, what else could Paul Heyman specifically really do for this man that would have been a major deal? Like, outside of Heyman just dropping to his knees and saying, I no longer acknowledge you, my tribal chief, and then nutshotting Roman Reigns. Like, realistically, what else could he have done? You know, we had all these guys out there. They built this up throughout the entire show. They opened the show with a segment with Punk and Heyman. Roman wasn't there yet. Punk said, when he comes, you let me know, because this is going to affect him. And that's when I knew. Once he mentioned that, I was like, okay, I can see where this is going. And Seth Rollins showed up. It all built throughout the entire show to a match, a segment at the end of the show, where Roman came out with Paul Heyman. I've never seen this man power walk to the ring as quickly as I did on Friday night. And then Seth Rollins came out. And then finally CM Punk came out. They were in Chicago, so of course he was adored. And they really milked this as long as they could. And then finally Punk said, I want Paul Heyman to be my wise man at WrestleMania and be in my corner for this triple threat match. So basically Roman's wise man is going to be Punk's wise man on WrestleMania Night 1. Because there's a lot of history there between these two men. And also, remember, Punk did tell Roman before War Games. Roman made the comment. Remember they were in the ring? And Roman said, you know, and this was off mic, but you could read their lips. He said, he's my wise man. And Punk said, we'll see. Well, at WrestleMania, he will be. And it does create tension now between Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman. Because when he told Heyman, you know, tell him no, And Heyman said, I can't. He said, no, I can't do that. Roman got very upset. He cornered Heyman until Punk came over and attacked Roman, and things broke down at that point. So it creates tension now in the relationship between Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman, which is almost more like captor and hostage. I mean, that's really been their relationship for 5 years now. But if Punk asked for Heyman's help during the match, does Paul Heyman help CM Punk if it means something, you know, is going to be done to Roman? Or if Roman says, wise man, you know, grab a chair or something and hand it to me. And then Heyman says, oh, you know, I can't do that, right? This is what we're in for at WrestleMania. Like, the main event of WrestleMania Night 1 now is really all about the soap opera around Paul Heyman and his loyalty and where his loyalty lies. And this is why I think in the end, this all benefits one person. That person is Seth Rollins. Because with Heyman being pulled in two different directions here, in the end, he's like fucking Stretch Armstrong here. He doesn't know what side he wants to be on. He may just throw his hands up and say, fuck the both of you. And that leads to a Seth Rollins win. Not that Heyman necessarily leaves with Rollins, only that it blows up in their faces. And Rollins, right, ever the opportunist, he kind of swoops in and takes advantage and he picks up the W. And then from there, you could always branch off with Roman and Punk one-on-one, maybe a backlash or something. But that's at this time right now, we still got 2 weeks to go. But at this moment, that's kind of how I see things playing out. Now, the other big news coming out of SmackDown on Friday involved Kevin Owens, who was scheduled for a singles match against Randy Orton at WrestleMania. And it started really early in the day on Friday. There was a Twitter report from PWN, Pro Wrestling Nexus, that Kevin Owens was said to be dealing with an undisclosed injury, and there was no set timeline for his return. It said, with just days until WrestleMania, his scheduled match against Randy Orton is now in jeopardy. And WWE has reportedly discussed backup plans for Orton, but no final decision has been made yet. And that was the report. And they pointed out that Kevin Owens has not wrestled a match since Elimination Chamber on March 1st against Sami Zayn when they had that unsanctioned match. And then slowly but surely, others like Dave Meltzer and Sean Ross Sapp, they confirmed that there was an injury. Meltzer said that it was said to be significant. And then on SmackDown, we found out how significant it really was. Nick Aldis was in the ring to introduce Kevin Owens down to the ring to make an announcement in his own words. And Owens said that he has been doing this now for 25 years. And in those 25 years, he gave everything he had every single time he set foot inside this ring. He's had the chance to experience things that he'll never forget and take care of his family, but there's a price to pay for that amazing opportunity, and that is the toll that it takes on their bodies. Every guy and girl in the back has paid that price at different times, and now it seems that it's his turn. For the last 4 months, he's been dealing with a pretty serious neck injury. And they didn't know how serious it was, but this week they found out, and now he's got to go have neck surgery. And the timing could not be any worse. Not being able to get in the ring with Randy Orton really sucks. He thanked WWE for giving him the chance to come out and say all of this, because he doesn't know when he'll be able to be out there in front of the people again. So for now, he wants to say thank you, and he's sorry. Definitely not the kind of promo that you would cut if you were this big, you know, heel villain character on the show. This was Kevin Owens coming out there and being very serious and being very upfront and kind of baring his soul to the audience. And clearly he was devastated. I mean, you could just read it on his face. Randy Orton's music hits just as Owens is getting ready to leave. He made it as far as the apron, and then he got stopped at his tracks by Orton's music, and Orton slowly makes his way down. The two of them share a brief stare on the apron before Owens drops down and heads to the back. And in the ring, Nick Aldis broke the bad news to Randy that with the injury to Owens, Randy no longer has a match for WrestleMania. And Orton, you know, head in his hands, he's hunched over, he looks devastated. And then came the RKO out of nowhere, and he drops the SmackDown GM. And then he looked up at the WrestleMania sign, and then he looked back down at Aldis on the mat before leaving. Now let's focus on Kevin Owens here for a few minutes. Owens recorded a podcast interview with Robbie Fox for his My Mom's Basement podcast on Friday. This was before SmackDown, so it didn't get released until Saturday, but he confirmed during the podcast the nature of the injury. He said, over the last few months, I've had an issue in my matches that made me go, I think something's not right. And then we looked into it and found out, yeah, there's something going on with my neck. I know for a fact there's a specific moment where it happened, because in December, I did a full body MRI just on my own for curiosity, just to see if there's anything that I should be aware of. And it's the thing where, yeah, you could see, you know, if you have issues with your bone structure or whatever, or your organs, anything like that. And at the time, the report came back that my knees were shit, but I've been well aware of that for a long time, so there's no concern there. But there's something about my spine and mild to moderate stenosis, which I showed it to the WWE doctors, and they're like, yeah, for what you guys do, everyone's got a level of stenosis. Everyone on earth walking around has a level of stenosis. Yours is your spine and your neck, and everything looks good. Everything looks good for what you've been doing. You're fine. So great. And I felt great. But then in January, I had a match. And in the match, two things happened that really jarred my neck. And that's when the issues started. So I knew there was something. And then we ended up doing an MRI this week and found out that, yeah, it's serious. So I think the match in January is what did it, because I had an MRI a month before and everything looked fine. Now, he didn't say who the match was against, but he only had two matches in January, one against Rey Mysterio and the other against Jimmy Uso. And in the match with Mysterio, Rey got his knees up on an Owen Swanton bomb, and he took the brunt of the impact right to his spine. Like, not even the back of his neck or the back of his head, like to his spine. And he also took a hard sunset bomb off the middle rope, which, again, doesn't look any different than any other rough-looking sunset bomb, because that's a tough move to take in the way your head whiplashes off the mat. But it didn't look like anything out of the ordinary. It's a brutal move, but he did take that move in the same match. So if it wasn't those two spots that he's referring to in that match, I'm sure those two bumps didn't help his case, but that may have been what did it. And that's the thing that's crazy about wrestling, is that you look at the brutal bumps that he took in his ladder match with Cody Rhodes at the Royal Rumble, right? Including the finish, especially the finish. When he got planted through that ladder bridge on the floor, I mean, he looked like he was destroyed. Or the unsanctioned match with Sami Zayn at Elimination Chamber. He worked both of those matches with a neck that needed surgery and didn't even know it. And while I'm sure those matches didn't do him any favors, like, those weren't even the matches where he got hurt. The match where he got hurt was just a regular match on SmackDown with no big ladder bumps, no table bumps, no chairs, no plunder, like nothing too crazy. Like, that's what did him in. Now, he didn't specify what type of surgery it is. PW Insider, though, did say that people backstage on Friday were talking about him getting a spinal fusion. He said he figures he's done for the year. He can't say that for sure because he hasn't had a conversation with his surgeon yet. That's going to happen on Monday, tomorrow, in Birmingham. But his expectation is that he has wrestled his final match for 2025. And the next time we see him back in the ring, it'll be 2026. And he says it bums him out, not only because he really wanted to wrestle Randy Orton, you know, one-on-one. They wrestled last year at WrestleMania, but you had Logan Paul in there. He's like, yeah, you know, we had that other annoying guy in there. I was looking forward to getting that one-on-one match at WrestleMania with Randy Orton. But what also bums him out, he really wanted one last match with John Cena. And now that is very unlikely to ever happen. He also said that he was upset that the news leaked early, saying, I woke up to seeing that it was already leaked, and it really upsets me, especially because I know that whoever leaked it is some office employee that shouldn't know this shit in the first place. I told people, like, this is going to leak, and they're like, no, we're keeping it tight-knit. But then yesterday, obviously, some departments had to find out for some reason, and now someone who should know this stuff found out, and it went where it shouldn't. And now they took away my right to tell people, because now everybody already knows. So there will be no punt kick. I thought when this news first broke, maybe they were just going to do the angle on SmackDown, you know, and just kind of use that as the storyline reason to write him off TV. They didn't do that. We had no resolution to the Orton storyline, which, you know, isn't really important in the big picture, but it sucks. You know, Randy Orton sat out for 4 months, selling a pile driver, all to build to this one match and that one moment, that punt kick at WrestleMania, and he never got his revenge on Kevin Owens for it. So maybe it was a case where Owens himself went to them and said, can I just go out there and be honest about this and come clean? Maybe that was something he himself wanted to do. But as far as him leaving, and look, it's a very shitty situation. There's never a good time to get hurt. There's never a good time to have spinal fusion, if that's what it is, spinal fusion surgery. That's a major surgery. That could keep him out for over a year. Any kind of neck surgery is a serious surgery. But that one in particular, you know, there's a long recovery period, you know, from that. And that's a tough thing for someone, I'm sure, who is constantly on the road and just wants to be active and involved. And now you're kind of sitting at home and you're bored. I mean, it'll give him time to do other things. He was kind of joking in the interview with Robbie about, now I'll have more time not just to be with my kids, but also to go to concerts. I never get to go to concerts and play with my cars. He's a big car guy now. So, I mean, you got to look at the silver lining in it. But this is a guy who has gone out there over the last several months, since this whole story began of him and Cody and, you know, him going heel, and he's done a hell of a job with it. And they had that match at the Royal Rumble, which was just fucking, like I said, brutal as all hell. It's a great match. You had the unsanctioned match with Sami Zayn at Elimination Chamber. Great match. And they blew it off quickly because they were building to him and Randy. Otherwise, they could have just saved him and Sami for WrestleMania, but they didn't do that. And now here we are, by the way, in Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. Neither one are going to be on the WrestleMania card this year. 2 years ago, they were in the main event of night one. Now they're not even on the show. But Owens is one of their MVPs. He always has been. He's that perfect guy that they can plug into whatever role they need him for. He could be a babyface. He could be a heel. I used to say the same thing about Kane, right? That's what Kane was for many years. He was a main event guy, and then they kind of phased him down a little bit, but he was always that reliable hand they could go to fill whatever role they needed, and they knew he would, you know, he would be able to do what they needed him to do. And Owens, you know, he always knocked it out of the park. His promo work, the promos with him sitting in his car, you know, and telling Michael Cole, hey, you have to come out here to interview me. And like, his promo work was, you know, carrying that entire feud really with him and Cody. And then Cody, you know, kind of stepped up his game. So the work he's been putting in the last few months alone has been, you know, tremendous stuff. And it sucks that, you know, he's injured enough that they're not even, you know, in a position to clear him to even get to WrestleMania. It's like, well, let's just get to Mania. We'll do an angle or something. Like, nope. This is serious enough that you have to have surgery now. So it's just a shitty situation. I hope he gets well. I hope he's able to come back as close to 100% as he can be. But still, even to this day, I feel like still one of the most, or one of the more kind of underappreciated, I would say underrated, he's not underrated, underappreciated talents that they have on that roster. Now, as far as what Randy Orton does at WrestleMania, he dropped Nick Aldis with an RKO. Not the first time that this has happened. 2 years ago, when he dropped Aldis with an RKO the first time, he had to pay a $50,000 fine. Now, remember Orton handed him the check? And it was $100,000. And Aldis said, the fine is only $50,000. You handed me a check for $100,000. And Orton said, that's for the next one. Well, the next one came on Friday. And so now Nick Aldis has a reason, unless they want to turn him into a Vince McMahon type character. I mean, God forbid. They want to turn him into a Vince McMahon type of like heel authority figure who just enlists other people to kind of fight his battles for him. You don't really have to do that. Nick Aldis now has a reason to want to get in the ring himself with Randy Orton. If ever there was an opening for him to get back in the ring for even just a one-off, this is it. And for it to happen at WrestleMania, of all places, against one of the biggest stars in the company, it would be a hell of a moment for Aldis, albeit on 2 weeks' notice. I mean, not a lot of prep time for him, but you know, it looks like he keeps himself in good shape. I think that's the match for WrestleMania. There's no need to complicate things. Orton is not going to miss his WrestleMania match after already sitting out for 4 months and missing the Royal Rumble, right? He's going to be on the show. He's going to wrestle somebody. They already teased Aldis as the direction here. There's no reason to plug him in anywhere else on the card. And there's no good reason to plug someone in there who's new. Like, let's say a debuting Aleister Black. Because I'm sure there's a lot of fantasy booking going on. And maybe plug somebody new like that who returns or makes their debut there. This is a match that Randy Orton has to win. Because Backlash, 3 weeks later, is in his hometown of St. Louis. And there's a very good chance that he is going to be in the main event of that show. Possibly competing for the WWE Championship. So you can't very well have him go into WrestleMania and lose and then turn around and potentially compete for the title 3 weeks later. That makes no sense. Aldis is the safest choice here. One and done. Aldis gets his WrestleMania moment. Randy picks up the win. And onward we go. And then there was Charlotte Flair and Tiffany Stratton. This was the train wreck segment of the night on Friday. We had the split screen interview a couple of weeks ago via satellite, right? We had Charlotte on one side of the screen, Tiffany on the other. It was not a good night for Tiffany. Charlotte talked over her. She just completely demolished her in that promo. Tiffany did not come out of that looking good at all. And so she really needed a comeback here. But this is the first time that we had them one-on-one, physically in the ring together for a segment like this. And they had Wade Barrett in the ring to moderate. It was less a matter of him moderating and more a matter of having somebody in there who could physically get in between them, because there were a couple of times where Charlotte got close to Tiffany as she was speaking and Wade had to step in between them as if to remind Charlotte to like back up a little bit. But he gave her the first question. He asked Charlotte, give a little more depth as to why you chose Tiffany as your WrestleMania opponent, and do you still feel like that was a wise choice? And Charlotte said Tiffany was begging, and she's the gift that keeps on giving. Tiffany wanted a moment, and Charlotte hadn't done any charity work lately, so she gave her her moment. And yes, she did make the right choice. Tiffany asked if she was done. Are you done? Did you get your woo in? Charlotte's biggest competitor, she said, has been the fans. And no matter how long you've been out for, that's a battle that you will never win. Charlotte likes to act like nothing gets to her, but then she's out here crying on some talk show. And she's referring to the Sherry Shepherd show. Charlotte went on there and did a segment. I don't know how many people in the crowd would have even known about this, but that's what that was in reference to. So she says, which one is it? And the saddest part about all this, no matter how many titles that you win, you will always come second to your daddy, Ric Flair. And at WrestleMania, you're going to come second to Tiffany Stratton. So Charlotte said Tiffany just regurgitated what all of her opponents have said about her over the last 10 years. And at this point in the promo, the crowd in Chicago were actively trying to drown this woman out with boos, right? The booing was so intense that she had to stop her promo. And then she tried to speak again. And she said, it doesn't matter if Tiffany... And then she got cut off again by the loud booing. And Tiffany goes, what's the matter, Charlotte? Cat got your tongue? And Charlotte said, she's got like this smile on her face. It's almost like a coping mechanism where she'll smile. But it's like that meme of like the smiling like troll face or whatever, but then like it's like a mask and underneath you can see them crying. Like, I feel like that's what it is. And Charlotte's got this big smile on her face. And she said, no, they're booing so loud. And they continue to boo. She goes, here's the thing. And the booing just got to her so much that she gave up. And she said, Tiffany, you can go ahead and have the last word. Which, this is Charlotte Flair. So you knew that in the end, of course, Tiffany wasn't going to be allowed to have the last word. But she said, you go ahead and have the last word. This woman was legitimately rattled by the reaction. And she just decided to give the floor to her opponent like she didn't know how to respond to any of this. And Tiffany said that at 25 years old, what was Charlotte doing? Trying to become a volleyball player, drinking in your daddy's basement. And at the age of 25, I'm walking into WrestleMania as the WWE Women's Champion. You say this is just another match to you? Seems I've gotten to you, Charlotte. And your WrestleMania record may be 4-3, and you may be the queen inside the ring, but outside the ring, and she stumbled over her words a little bit here, but she said, outside the ring, you ain't the queen of shit, right? That was going to be like the big line there, and they censored it, but Charlotte stepped all over her punchline by talking over her. Like, right as she was getting to the end of the insult, Charlotte just started talking over her. And then the worst part about the entire thing, Charlotte begins squawking like a bird. And she said that Tiffany sounded squeaky. And she starts, I don't even know how to describe the noises that she was making, like mocking her. And then she acted like she couldn't hear her. Again, this felt like a total coping mechanism from this woman. And Tiffany said for 16 more days, Charlotte gets to call herself WWE's least favorite Nepo baby, which is the second Nepo baby reference on TV this week. John Cena used the same line against Cody on Monday. And Charlotte corrected her and said, Nepo Queen. But then Charlotte also referred to herself as the number one Nepo baby. So which is it? Tiffany said that when she beats her at WrestleMania, when it's all said and done, Charlotte is going to be just like you are outside of the ring, alone. What's that record? 0-3? Referring to her number of failed marriages. And then Tiffany wooed, dropped the mic, and rolled out of the ring as quickly as possible. And Charlotte, who said that she was going to give Tiffany the last word, couldn't help herself. And told her, hey, Tiffany, is that why Kaiser is in my DMs? Because, of course, she had to get the last word in because that's just the way it is. And it was just so, like, thrown out there. Like, there's no way that was obviously planned. She was bothered by what Tiffany said. And the reaction of the crowd didn't help. And she felt like I have to throw something out there. So, hey, I got Kaiser in my DMs. She might have Kaiser in her DMs. She might have, Bert Kaiser, maybe Matthew Kaiser. I'm sure there may well be multiple men by the name of Kaiser in her DMs. I'm sure that Ludwig is not one of them. Now, immediately after this segment was over, WrestleVotes tweeted, Charlotte and Tiffany said very little of what was in the rundown for them. Off script quite a bit. Of course. Charlotte got thrown off by the fans booing her midway through and not letting her speak, and she didn't know how to handle it. Mike Johnson had this report on PW Insider. The SmackDown face-off with Charlotte Flair and Tiffany Stratton went well off the planned back-and-forth verbiage. Towards the end of the segment, there were references made by Stratton about Flair being alone and 0-3 outside of the ring, which was an allusion to her divorces. Followed by Flair asking why Stratton's significant other, Ludwig Kaiser, was in Flair's DMs. The belief among those we've spoken with this morning is that Stratton fired away on Flair in retaliation for how Flair ate her up on a previous face-to-face segment. Some that we spoke with felt Stratton stood up for herself in a way that put the spotlight back on her, and in front of a Chicago crowd that was sincerely pro-Stratton, while others felt that the segment going awry towards the end did not help anybody. Several we spoke to also noted that Flair was obviously thrown by the crowd, which allowed Stratton's shots to hit even harder. Flair's final comment about Kaiser came after Stratton had already rolled out of the ring and began exiting the arena. One source referred to it as coming off like a flailing shot from a boxer who didn't realize they were KO'd, and that Flair was obviously gotten to. Several of the comments made were cut from WWE's YouTube highlights of the segment. Which is true, by the way, but USA Network has their own YouTube channel, and they have the full segment up uncensored and unedited, at least for now, if you want to go check out what all the hubbub is about. Now, Dave Meltzer had this write-up about it. What we were directly told is that the situation has been brewing, and those close to the situation said that neither was in the right, but that Flair is taking most of the heat. The Chicago crowd booed Flair heavily from the start, and even more as it continued. Stratton got a mixed reaction at first with light Tiffy time chants, but the crowd got more behind her as the segment went on. It appeared they got more behind her because they hated Flair more so than they were really behind Stratton, who didn't really come across like a babyface either. We do know the problems were early, and it wasn't the 0-3 marriage line that caused them. If it was the 0-3 line that was the first that went off script, the heat would have been more on Stratton. There was a part in the promo earlier where Wade Barrett tried to get in between them that did not appear planned and may have been his sense to keep them apart. Flair responded by saying Ludwig Kaiser is in her DMs, which just seemed really weird particularly calling him Kaiser, which is a stage name, like it was part of an angle. It should be noted that everybody seems to be told that it was a segment that fell apart, exactly the way it appeared. One person there did say that it's during WrestleMania season, so you can't say 100% either way. But we were told from someone close to it that Flair went off script first, and the lines from her standpoint, were retaliation. Her rolling out of the ring like a heel was to avoid... Stratton now. Her rolling out of the ring like a heel was to avoid getting worse and a defense mechanism. This would be consistent with Flair having more heat on her than Stratton, according to one person very close to the situation, who would not provide any specific details past that, in that there was heat on both and neither was the good guy. If it was all part of some elaborate work to make it feel real and to garner attention, it certainly accomplished the latter of the two because people have been talking about it now for the past 2 days. Do I think it was a work? Absolutely not. And whether it is or it isn't, it was a train wreck either way. Now, some people like to watch train wrecks, right? It's like the cars that rubberneck to look at the car crash on the highway. I think this feud sucks. And every time these two get together, it's very awkward and it's very uncomfortable and not in a way that is that I find entertaining. Maybe you do. It's awkward and uncomfortable in a way that I don't find entertaining, and it certainly doesn't make me any more interested in seeing them wrestle at WrestleMania. It just makes for bad television. And it's not the first time that Charlotte Flair has been involved in an awkward segment on television. Need I remind you of the belt swap with Becky Lynch? And there was legitimate heat between those two as well. To the point where, if you remember, they got into a shouting match when they got to the back, and Charlotte had to be escorted out of the building. Charlotte really does think that she is the queen bee. It's not just a gimmick on TV. And when she feels threatened, or when things don't go her way, you end up with something like what we saw on Friday. She was clearly rattled by the crowd reaction. We see people like Dominic Mysterio or The New Day after their heel turn. They get nuclear heat where you can barely hear them. The boos are so loud. It's the sort of thing that, like, as a heel, you would kill for a reaction like that. Now, with Dominic, I think it's more a case of, honestly, people having fun booing him. The thing with Dominic Mysterio heat, it's not go-away heat. Like, they're having fun booing him. And he's very good in his role. With Charlotte, it's more, and this was certainly the case on Friday, it's more, we don't like you, and we want you out of the ring and off our TV. And she just doesn't react well to it. She doesn't know how to handle it. You would think for as long as she has been doing this now, 10 years on the main roster, and for being the daughter of Ric Flair, one of the greatest promos in the history of the business, a man who knew how to manipulate a crowd like very few others, how to master an audience. It's almost impressive how shockingly bad she is at it. You know, I don't know why something like that would get to her as much as it did, but that's what happened. And honestly, I really think it goes back to that first promo on Raw after she won the Royal Rumble, when she was spilling her guts to the fans about her injury and not knowing if she would ever return, and the people booed her. She wasn't expecting it. And it just feels like she's been having a hard time adapting to that ever since. For Tiffany, well, I mean, look, if Tiffany also went off script here and threw some shots at her in retaliation for what Charlotte did to her, then good for her. I've criticized her promos and her delivery before. Tiffany Stratton has not evolved as a character. She has not evolved her promos. She has not evolved her delivery. Now she's a babyface. Before she was a heel. Nothing has changed. And her promos are just not that great. And she got dressed down very badly by Charlotte in that split screen. But she was a lot better here. And that's the nicest thing that I could say about any of this. I only hope that their in-ring chemistry is better than their chemistry on the microphone, because they have none. And I have no interest in seeing them interact again at all before WrestleMania. Keep them far apart from each other until then. We had Rey Fénix on this show making his debut, a successful debut against Nathan Frazer, one half of the NXT Tag Team Champions, who they called up to do the honors. Almost killed himself on a suicide dive, jumping out of the ring, got his feet caught on the middle rope. I mean, that's what happens when you move that fast. I mean, this guy, he's tremendous, but he goes at such a quick pace that you're just asking for something like that to happen. Thankfully, nobody got hurt. I thought it was a very good debut for Phoenix. It was very similar to the debut that they gave Penta. You know, they found the right opponent for him and Chad Gable. The entrances were very similar. They both got pyro. They were both received very well by the audience, and they both got promo time in the ring when the match was over. You know, Byron Saxton got in the ring, and he interviewed Phoenix, and Phoenix, you know, cut a promo. You could tell how emotional he was and how important it was for him to finally be there. This is something he's been waiting for a very long time. And so I thought both debuts were very similar. I still think Penta had the better debut, but this was a very good first appearance for Rey Fénix. And they already set up a match for him for next week. It's going to be Humberto from Legado del Fantasma. He'll be and that's going to be a great match, of course. The rumor is that he's going to be working a program soon with Andrade. I don't know if that's a match that they're going to set up for WrestleMania. I'm not sure why he had to debut now if he's not going to be on the WrestleMania card instead of saving it for after WrestleMania. But that is the belief, is that he'll be working with Andrade very soon. Jade Cargill against Naomi has been made official for WrestleMania. That will be the first singles match between two women at a WrestleMania with no championship on the line in at least two decades. And they also crowned number one contenders for both the U.S. and tag team titles. Jacob Fatu beat Braun Strowman in a last man standing match. So Jacob Fatu is going to WrestleMania, his very first one, and he'll be challenging LA Knight for the United States Championship in a match that some people may think Jacob Fatu is going to win a title. I don't happen to be one of those people, because I think this is all building to a match between him and Solo Sikoa at Backlash and not for the U.S. title. And the tag team titles will be defended by the Street Profits against the Motor City Machine Guns, who beat DIY on Friday night. That will also be the first WrestleMania match for Alex Shelley and Chris Sabin, which for them, as long as they've been doing this for, is actually very cool. Today's episode is sponsored by Hims. Guys, there are a lot of things that you can do in 3 to 6 months. Maybe you want to take acting lessons. In 3 to 6 months, though, you're probably not going to be all that good. You could hit the weights at the gym, try to bulk up, and still not make a dent in your physique, especially if your diet doesn't change. You could decide you want to train to become a pro wrestler. Unless you're Kurt Angle, you're probably not going to be that good in 3 to 6 months. Or you can start seeing thicker, fuller hair regrowth through Hims. Call it the Hims effect. Hims provides you with convenient and quality access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple with doctor-trusted options and clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Choose from personalized, chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatments to find what works best for you. Hims makes the process simple and convenient, and it's 100% online. So there are no uncomfortable doctor visits. You don't need to have a panic attack sitting in some waiting room. This eliminates all of that stress. Answer a few questions, and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is then sent directly to you for free. No insurance is needed. And one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, and they can help you get your confidence back too with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/solomonster. That's hims.com/solomonster for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/solomonster. Results vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. With WrestleMania returning to Las Vegas for the first time since 1993, WWE is releasing a new behind-the-scenes documentary for WrestleMania 9 from Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. Or more accurately, the back parking lot of Caesar's Palace, which is where they constructed their little makeshift arena. Yeah, they also used it for boxing events. To this day, the most indie-rific WrestleMania, unless you count the empty arena one during COVID at the Performance Center, WrestleMania comes to the Caesar's Palace parking lot. They're calling it WrestleMania 9 Becoming a Spectacle. That's the documentary dropping this coming Friday, April 11th. They put a trailer out for it. I have no idea how long the runtime is, but it has interviews with Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart, The Undertaker, Bruce Pritchard, and former WWE executive Basil DeVito, among others. You know, WrestleMania 9 is an interesting one because a lot of people say that it is the worst WrestleMania of all time. It's not the worst WrestleMania of all time. It's among the worst, but it's not the worst. WrestleMania 11 is the worst WrestleMania of all time. WrestleMania 2 is worse than WrestleMania 9. WrestleMania 27 was worse with the one with the John Cena Miz main event. You know, WrestleMania 9 didn't feel like a WrestleMania because of the environment that they were in. They tried something different and it didn't really work, but it was unique. Hulk Hogan showed up with his eye all fucked up, either from a jet ski accident or because Randy Savage beat the shit out of him. It all depends on what story you believe. Undertaker and Giant Gonzalez, they had one of the worst matches in WrestleMania history. And the finish was a bunch of nonsense, although to a young Solo Monster, in the moment, I thought it was cool. Right through those eyes, it may have been cool, but as I got older and watched it back, I realized how ridiculous it all was, especially when it felt like they were moving away from the Hogan era. And then he comes back and he pulls that shit. I'm sure I'll get into the details more next week after I've watched the documentary about what went down with Hogan and Bret Hart. It's one of the reasons Bret Hart came to hate the guy, hate his guts. Since they're both interviewed for it, I'm sure it'll come up. And I'll mention this because I did cover the story years ago on the show when it looked like the movie would never see the light of day. But that has all changed now. John Cena filmed a live-action CGI Looney Tunes movie a few years ago called Coyote vs. Acme, where he plays the Coyote's former boss at Acme. So you basically think of Who Framed Roger Rabbit or Space Jam, right? They blend real life with animation. Warner Brothers Discovery had canceled plans to release the film even though it was already completed, and it had actually tested well with audiences. They canceled it so they could get a huge tax break and just write the film off. They did the same thing with the Batgirl movie, which was in post-production at the time that it got shut down and it was never finished. Nor will anyone ever get to see what they did finish, and that may be for the better because the new head of DC and James Gunn, they both said that film should never be released. I guess what they saw, they agreed that it would be better if it was never actually shown to anybody else. But that wasn't the case with Coyote versus Acme. And so imagine, you know, you're spending all that time making a movie. If you're a director, if you're an actor, and yeah, you're still being paid for your work, but you film an entire movie just to have it put on a shelf so that nobody can ever see it. Will Forte, he also stars in the film with John Cena. He was furious about it at the time. He called it fucking bullshit, and that the decision not to release it makes my blood boil. All the stories at the time said that David Zaslav, the head of Warner Brothers Discovery, he didn't even watch the film. He just wanted it deleted. Evidently, they never did delete it, because now comes word that it will finally see the light of day. Per Deadline.com, Warner Brothers Discovery has completed the sale that we told you about a couple of weeks ago for their previously shelved Coyote vs. Acme movie. Ketchup Entertainment today confirmed their completed deal for worldwide rights to the live-action animated hybrid film that brings Looney Tunes character Wile E. Coyote to the big screen. We had the deal pegged at the $50 million range, and the film is expected to get a theatrical release in 2026. The film is based on the Looney Tunes characters and the New Yorker humor article called Coyote, that's a different cartoon, Coyote vs. Acme by Ian Frazier. Will Forte, John Cena, Lana Condor, and Tony Bell star in the movie, which follows Wile E. Coyote, who after Acme products fail him one too many times in his dogged pursuit of the Roadrunner, decides to hire a billboard lawyer to sue the Acme Corporation. The case pits Wile E. Coyote and his lawyer, Will Forte, against the latter's intimidating former boss, John Cena, but a growing friendship between man and cartoon stokes their determination to win. I'm going to have to see this movie now when it finally comes out. Imagine if the movie turns out to be shit. Like, after all of this, Like, you go see the movie, you're like, man, that was terrible. That was a horrible movie. Now, you know, I grew up on those Roadrunner cartoons with the coyote. I can still watch them today, and they still make me laugh. Not that I'm sitting around watching Roadrunner cartoons all day long, but, like, if I'm thinking about it, like, a story like this, I want to go look up clips on YouTube or something, like, it still makes me laugh. Like, that kind of animation and humor is just timeless. And holy shit, you talk about a segue. We go from talking about Roadrunner cartoons to Ludwig Borga. This week's Dark Side of the Ring focused on Tony Halme, better known in the wrestling world as Ludwig Borga, who led quite the interesting life. He didn't last very long in WWE, all of 6 months, but he was also headlined in New Japan Pro Wrestling. He fought mixed martial arts, including he was Randy Couture's very first opponent in the UFC. He was a boxer, he was an author, he was an actor, he was a singer, he was a politician in the Finnish parliament. He was also a drug addict, an alcoholic, and a racist neo-Nazi piece of shit. Basically the exact opposite of what we saw last week in the episode on Mick Foley, who is regarded as one of the nicest people ever in the wrestling business. Borga was anything but. And that makes him perfect for a show like Dark Side of the Ring, even though the actual wrestling portion of the episode is actually pretty small, compared to the overall picture here. They interviewed a bunch of people here. One of them was the journalist who actually wrote Halme's biography, who said that he came from a broken home with his parents divorcing when he was only 2 years old. So right off the bat, they give you an insight into what may have contributed to the type of person that he would grow up to become. You know, it may have shaped his experiences at a very young age, and that led to ultimately what we see here in this episode. But he was looked at as an outsider as a child. His mother enrolled him in a Swedish school, even though he was Finnish. And they also interviewed his childhood friend. They interviewed one of his ex-wives. Jim Ross was interviewed, Jim Cornette, both of whom worked with him in WWE and were around him. His ex-wife said that he desperately wanted to be famous. So he came up with this persona called the Viking. And this was years before he ever got into pro wrestling. He didn't even know of pro wrestling. He never watched as a kid. He wasn't a fan of it. After he moved to the United States, he met his ex-wife, Dee Dee. And some guys in the gym one day suggested that he might want to become a pro wrestler because he had a unique look. He was a big guy. And that led to him joining the UWF as the Viking under Herb Abrams. Herb Abrams got a hold of this guy, another psychopath that's been given the Dark Side of the Ring treatment before. After that, he got his big break working in Japan. And they even had video of him wrestling Big Van Vader. He got a big push right out of the gate. He was not over nearly at the level that they pushed him at. But he had claimed to be the heavyweight boxing champion of Finland, which was bullshit. But they accepted him as a tough guy because he looked the part. You know, he looked like a big, scary guy, and people bought into it. He also beat his body to shit working that Japanese style. He got hooked on painkillers while he was over there. And they touched on the famous story of his fight with Scott Norton in Japan. And he and Norton actually held the IWGP tag team titles together at one point. But that all fell apart after at least one, if not two, very real fights that they had outside the ring. Now, I don't remember if it was in a bar or if it was in the locker room. I can't remember which. But in the episode, you know, as they tell it, Halme was friendly with a lot of people who were either part of the White Brotherhood or were sympathetic to their cause. Okay, skinheads, basically. And the wrong word slipped out of his mouth one day, and Norton heard this. And it probably wasn't the first time that he heard something like this, but whatever it was, it finally set him off. This they didn't get into on the show, but they actually had one fight that got broken up by the other wrestlers. And then later that same night, Halme sucker punched Norton and knocked him out. And he didn't last too much longer after that before leaving Japan. He made the jump to WWE. Rick Bassman is the one who got him booked there. Like, literally, he wrestled for New Japan in June of 93 for the last time, and by July, he was working for Vince. And he actually debuted 2 days after Lex Luger slammed Yokozuna on the Intrepid. And Ludwig Borga was born. And Jim Cornette said, you know, he was there for Borg's run. He talked about Vince McMahon's affinity for the foreign heel gimmick in wrestling. Borga had an accent, so that means he's got to be the foreign menace. He's going to be the foreign menace from Finland, the Hellraiser from Helsinki. And the thing I remember about Borga's run, other than how bad it was him being the man to end Tatanka's 2-year undefeated streak. And they interviewed Tatanka for this episode. And Tatanka said that he was told they wanted to do something big for Borga. So he starts talking about like what it means to give someone the rub. What does it mean for somebody to get the rub in wrestling? And how if you rub shoulders with Hulk Hogan, it takes you up to a higher level. Tatanka comparing himself to Hulk Hogan in any way, shape, or form, even in the form of an analogy, is almost as batshit crazy as any of the lies that Hogan himself has ever told. Like, I was floored by this. But I remember the match. Borga used the chair, and then he pinned him with one finger. And it was a big deal at the time, because, again, Tatanka was protected for reasons I have no idea, but he was protected for 2 fucking years, like he's Roman Reigns. And then finally, Ludwig Borga comes in, and not only does he beat him, but he beats him with one finger on his chest. And Tatanka tells the producer that looking back at it now, Borga wasn't the right guy to end the streak. I think Repo Man should have been the guy, personally. But boy, yeah, Tatanka has a very inflated opinion of himself. Jim Ross said that Borga had a great look, but he was a miserable human being, and he made the people around him very uncomfortable. Sounds like a great hire. And then came the kicker. When they come to find out, after he's already been hired, they come to find out, I guess this isn't the sort of thing you would volunteer. You would write in on your resume. But they come to learn that this man has an SS tattoo on his calf. They did not see that coming. You know, Kevin Nash once told a story of walking through the streets of Tel Aviv with Borga. They did a show there in 93. And that's when he first noticed the SS tattoo for the first time. While they were walking through the streets of Tel Aviv, of all places. And so we had Jim Cornette in the episode here give us a brief history lesson about the SS being Hitler's private army who carried out a lot of his atrocities. And JR admits, he goes, we made a mistake in hiring him. He slipped by us. Yes, he slipped by them like he snuck through the back door of the building and he just fell into a big push where he was wrestling Lex Luger. Just kind of snuck in the back door. The background checks back then were very lenient, indeed. So they had him cover the tattoo with tape because they had to. I mean, think about it. Think about the heat they would get with USA Network and all of the syndicated stations that they aired on if that tattoo was visible on TV. They had more kids back then than anybody else watching the product. The last thing they needed to see was a fucking Nazi tattoo on this guy. And his ex-wife says he was fascinated by Nazis and he came back once from a trip to Russia with a picture and it had a swastika on the bottom of it. And she used it in their house as a flower pot. And she claimed that she was naive and she didn't know shit from Shinola at that age. Had no idea what it meant. And even more bizarre than the Nazi tattoo, that wasn't the only tattoo they talked about here in this episode. I already knew about the Nazi tattoo. What I didn't know about was the exit-only tattoo on his lower back right above his ass. And his ex-wife questions why someone would get such a tattoo. I mean, I don't know. You were married to him. Perhaps you should have had that conversation one day. They showed a photo of the tattoo, by the way, which I did not need to see. And Cornette had the line of the episode here. And he asked the question, which is a perfectly logical question to ask. What the fuck would compel a man to tattoo exit only above his asshole? Do you really need written instructions for people not to fuck you in the ass? The man's got a point. I mean, is he worried that at his next physical, the doctor might try to fuck him in the ass? I would suggest you find a new doctor if you've run into that problem before and give that man a 1-star review on Yelp. So you can add raging homophobe to the list of wonderful personality traits that this man possessed. Borg's WWE career really can be distilled down to this. Vince McMahon brought him in to be the lead foreign heel after Yokozuna against Lex Luger. And then, as Bruce Pritchard says, the bell rang. And it was like the blind leading the blinded there. Now, maybe after Luger won the title at WrestleMania 10, they would have used Borg as a first challenger for Luger to beat. I don't know. We know what happened to those plans for Lex to win the title at WrestleMania. But Lex had already beaten him at Survivor Series, and nobody had any reason to want to see the match after that. I mean, they didn't have a reason to want to see the match before that, because it wasn't any good. And as it turned out, Borga broke his ankle in a match against Rick Steiner at Madison Square Garden a few days before the Royal Rumble, and that was the end of his career there. He was supposed to be back in time for WrestleMania 10 against Earthquake. You can even find the match graphic floating around online to promote the match. But his ankle didn't heal up in time, and so they ended up going with Earthquake against Adam Bomb instead. And Borga just never returned. Now Pritchard has said that he got out of shape during his time off, and he just wanted to go back home. So they saw the chance to make a clean break, and they let him go. In this episode here, JR said that Borga got hurt, and nobody missed him. And he was glad that Borga did not get hired on his watch. Funny enough, not only did Borga's injury derail his career, Bret Hart was so over in that 94 Royal Rumble match, that's what convinced Vince McMahon to change his mind and go with Bret to win the belt at WrestleMania instead of Luger. So Borga was never going to get a shot at the title, probably regardless. He did get a shot at the Intercontinental title. And not only that, he won the championship twice in the same match. It was a Coliseum video match they taped at the end of 93. It was against Razor Ramon. I don't know how many of you know about this. First, he pinned Razor, even though Razor's foot was on the bottom rope, and the referee didn't see it. But then he restarted the match. And on the second try, Shawn Michaels ran in with his Intercontinental belt, and he whacked Razor in the back with it after the referee got bumped, so he didn't see it, and Borga pinned Razor for a second time. He got two pinfalls over Scott Hall in this match, and this time he actually celebrated with the title before a bunch of other referees ran in, like the little snitches they are, and the decision got reversed. But technically, on this night, Ludwig Borga, he pinned Razor Ramon twice and won the Intercontinental title. So after his career was over there, he did some boxing, and then he had his one and only MMA fight in May of 1997. So at the same time that Ken Shamrock, who fought in the UFC, was making his WWE debut against Vader, Halme was making his UFC debut at UFC 13 against the debuting Randy Couture, who would only go on to become one of the greatest fighters of all time and future UFC Hall of Famer. A little backstory to this is that they did not get into this here, but there were two other guys that Halme was scheduled to fight on that show, and each of them backed out when they saw how big he was, right? This big 300-plus-pound guy, you know, probably juiced to the gill on horse steroids. So they backed out, and that's when Couture stepped in. And Halme never took it seriously. He showed up to train a few days before the fight. One of the students there put him in an armbar and popped his elbow. But when it came time to fight, Halme's out there. He's bragging that, oh, nobody can make me tap out. And in the end, it took just under a minute for him to tap out. And that was the beginning and the end of his MMA career. Like, if you look at his Wikipedia page, he's got five MMA fights listed to his name. Those other four were not real MMA fights. He, quote-unquote, fought in the Rings promotion in Japan, and those were worked like a shoot, but they were a work. I think years later it turned into a shoot in Rings, but that came later on. So they talked about his home being raided one day, and he was charged with trafficking controlled substances, that being steroids. He was charged with illegal firearms possession. He went to prison. And some of the inmates there recognized him as Ludwig Borga, so they took him in. And of course, who took him in? The White Brotherhood took him in. What a shock. So then he gets deported back to Finland, and he is no longer allowed back in the United States. And after that, he joined the Finnish version of American Gladiators. He played a Viking character on the show. He recorded a song that sold so well, he ended up recording an entire album And they also showed him in the movie Die Hard with a Vengeance, which is one of my all-time favorite movies and one of the most quotable movies. The OG Die Hard, still the best one, but if you said the third one was, I would not argue with you. They are the two best ones in the entire series. And Halme had a bit part in the movie. Mostly it was a non-speaking role as one of the foreign bad guys. I recognized him straight away the first time I ever watched the movie. I said, what the hell is Ludwig Borga doing in Die Hard? Obviously, he filmed that before he got deported. That movie came out in 1995. He was deported in 1999. And it was a bit role, but it made him an even bigger star in Finland. And then he wrote a book. Actually, he wrote multiple books. And there were a lot of exaggerated stories about his life. There was a lot of hateful, offensive shit in those books. And that paved the way for his entry into politics. And there was a far, far right-wing party, or as his advisor at the time said in the episode, a kind of Nazi party that brought him in to run for parliament. And to borrow one of those quotable lines from Die Hard with a Vengeance, birds of a feather flock together. And that was the case with Halme. There was a recession in Finland at the time. All of the immigrants there became scapegoats for everybody else's problems. And he was a charismatic guy, which appealed to people because he wasn't your typical politician. And I'm not going to get into some of the specific things that he said because it's repulsive, but it appealed to a certain segment of the population. And it ended up getting him elected. And that didn't stop him from saying outlandish, offensive things to get attention in the media because in his mind, you know, even after he was elected, it was all about getting as much publicity and as much attention as possible. I'm sure he did believe a lot of the shit that he said, but even if he didn't, you know, he would say the most outlandish things because he knew it would get coverage. But he was also addicted to drugs and alcohol. He literally had a bowl of drugs and would grab handfuls of pills at different times during the day. I think he talked about that in one of his books. And people around him started resigning because they had enough of it. Nobody could get through to him. There was an incident with his new wife where a gun got fired in their home. No one was hurt, but he swallowed his own puke. He ended up in a coma for several weeks. It was all over the news in Finland. They actually aired the trial on TV over there, like he was O.J. Simpson, over the gun charge. But anyway, he ends up in this coma, and he was able to pull through, but it was very clear to those around him that he had brain damage, permanent brain damage. He was not the same person. Very much like Terry Gordy, you know, after he had that overdose on the plane. He lived several more years. You know, I think that happened in 93, I want to say, and I think he died in 2000. And he wrestled, but, you know, Terry Gordy was, he was never the same person, and he was never the same performer after the overdose. So his marriage failed again. He became depressed. He ended up getting charged in that shooting incident. He resigned from his position in parliament. He was a mess. And people would see him, he'd be at the bar or whatever, and people would laugh and make fun of him. And, you know, he would have, like, piss on, you know, he pissed himself. Like, he was a mess. And he got into debt. He was buying drugs off the black market. He was committed to a mental institution for delirium because of all the drinking that he was doing. And one day, his best friend showed up to his apartment. He couldn't get inside. Halme wouldn't answer, so he called the police. And when they got inside, they found him dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. And he was only 47 years old when he killed himself. And you might think, well, you know, even in death, surely they can find some people to say nice things about this man. But you would be wrong. His ex-wife says that she wasn't surprised when she heard the news, and she did not shed a single tear. She said he was a piece of shit and treated people horribly. Jim Ross said he was an asshole, and that's where I'll leave it. I'll say one good thing about him. He once said in a speech before Parliament that every single pedophile should get their nuts cut off and thrown into a dungeon for the rest of their life. I can endorse that. But in the end, he was someone who made far more of an impact in politics than he ever did in pro wrestling. You know, a lot of politicians in Finland after this ran on anti-immigration platforms for years after Halme's win, And there is a certain irony to that when you consider that Halme himself emigrated to the United States for a better life and to try to become famous. What he was, though, was a terrible person. He was a terrible person with few, if any, redeeming qualities. And that comes from the people who knew him best. And it's very telling when nobody has anything nice to say about you, even after you die. You know, in wrestling, he was your run-of-the-mill, prototypical mid-card foreign heel who never caught on. And as quickly as he showed up, he was gone. And he will be remembered more for the things he did outside of wrestling than anything he ever did in it. Now, this Tuesday, the Dark Side of the Ring episode will be covering Big Van Vader, which I am very much looking forward to that one. Here's the schedule for all of the remaining episodes. We have Vader this week. April 15th, it is Tony Atlas, Too Much Too Soon. April 22nd, Superstar Billy Graham. April 29th, Eddie Gilbert. May 6th, Billy Jack Haynes. May 13th will be the original Sheik. May 20th is the episode on Daphne. And I guess the season finale, May 27th, Muhammad Hassan. Those are the remaining episodes for season 6. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. You know the drill. Marlon from Memphis, Tennessee. I really like the Usos, and I have a fondness for Jay as well. I think if Cody Rhodes is going to lose the title to John Cena, which I believe he should, it's because a heel John Cena with a 17th world championship could bring so much more to the company. However, I don't think every major title should change hands on that same show. I believe Gunther should retain the World Heavyweight title, and there should be a significant angle following that match. For the main event on night one, I think Roman Reigns should win the triple threat against CM Punk and Seth Rollins. Just imagine the World Heavyweight Championship match on night two. After Gunther's win, he could destroy both Usos, leading to a surprise moment when Roman Reigns' music hits and he confronts Gunther. This would truly elevate the World Heavyweight Championship and create a huge surprise, especially considering Roman just won the main event on night one. Also, this scenario could facilitate Roman Reigns' much-needed move to Monday Night Raw, as I believe he and Cody should not be on the same show for now. Well, I agree with you there. I don't think Cody and Roman should be technically a part of the same roster. Roman winning the main event on night one just feels very unlikely to me right now. I mean, if I actually had to like rank them in order of who I think is the likeliest to walk away the winner, I probably would put Seth Rollins at number one, CM Punk at number two, and Roman at the bottom, dead last in number three. I just don't see, you know, what would even really be gained from him winning that match. I don't think he is going to win that match. And so maybe that negates the idea that you have here. Obviously, if he wins, then it makes more sense because where does he go from here if not to challenge for a championship? And I really don't have any interest in seeing him against Cody again or him against Cena even. I saw it years ago at SummerSlam. It wasn't even that good then. Roman against Gunther is a match that has not been done yet. So to that extent that it would be a fresh match, I like it. I don't know that it has to be for a championship. They could do that match even non-title. This scenario I don't see playing out. But it's not a bad idea to want to do something with Roman and Gunther at some point, or to get Roman and Cody off the same show. Look, I know a lot of people are dead set against Jey Uso winning the World Heavyweight Championship. I don't think that Jey Uso, if he wins it, should hold that title for very long. I really don't have any interest in seeing any kind of lengthy run, but they're doing it for the moment. And if Jey Uso goes in there after everything that has happened and loses again for the fourth time to Gunther, then that's it. Like, he can't be looked at the same way again at that point. It just will never again be the same. And I think they understand that, and I don't think they're sending him in there to be sabotaged like that. So while you may not want to see it, we are heading for a new World Heavyweight Champion at WrestleMania, whether people like it or not. So again, a very unlikely scenario here, but there are some ideas here that I'm not against. Jerry from San Antonio, I gave it a shot. I tried to be optimistic. That Cena heel turn was huge back at Elimination Chamber. Truly one of the best heel turns of all time. I sent you an email about 2 months ago or so about how leading into this WrestleMania in Las Vegas, no less, It felt super underwhelming. With 17 days to go, as he is writing this, I feel like it's super underwhelming. This Mania needs to be one night, that's it. But Punk then wouldn't get his main event spot. This is WrestleMania in Las Vegas, for God's sake. I've been to Vegas 10 times, and I dreamed of a vacation to go back with WrestleMania in the city. Unfortunately, I couldn't go this year because of my financial situation, but looking at the card, I think I'm going to be okay. How underwhelming is this WrestleMania card and build? Because this isn't what you were expecting either, was it? I wasn't expecting anything on the level of what we got last year, but has it been underwhelming? Yeah, it has been. It has felt underwhelming, and now certain things are starting to pick up. Here now we're a couple weeks out. We'll see when we get to the week of how it really feels. But yeah, the build to this WrestleMania has kind of been all over the place, and it has been nothing compared to what we had last year going into Philly. So if you want to compare it to that, I mean, there really is no comparison. But look, they're going to go to Las Vegas. They're going to make their money. They're not going to have nearly as many people in Allegiant Stadium as they've had for WrestleMania in recent years, and yet they'll still probably set all kinds of records because it's Vegas. And Vegas is expensive to begin with, but with the prices they're charging, you know, those premium prices they're charging, even with fewer people in the building each night, they're still going to set all kinds of records. They don't give a shit. They don't care. But yes, it has felt underwhelming. You're not wrong about that. Curtis in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. With the recent announcement of AJ Styles against Logan Paul at WrestleMania, it got me thinking about AJ and his WrestleMania resume thus far. For such a big name, it feels like his Mania resume is quite lackluster. The Shane McMahon match might be his best in-ring WrestleMania match, and I am not sure if that is a good thing or a bad thing. The Boneyard match is fantastic, but hard to judge because it's a cinematic match. Outside of those two, his WrestleMania matches and programs have felt underwhelming, especially considering how great of an in-ring talent he is. The Nakamura match felt like a letdown, coming off their Wrestle Kingdom match, and the rest of his matches have been average at best. In terms of big-name talent, his WrestleMania resume is lacking. Can you think of any other big-name talent having more a more disappointing WrestleMania resume than AJ? The other guy who springs to mind is Randy Orton. But even then, you could argue that he had good to great matches against Undertaker, Seth, and the Triple Threat at WrestleMania 31. Triple Threat at WrestleMania 31, I have no idea what you're talking about there. As far as big-name talent, yeah, I talked about one last week. His name is John Cena. John Cena's best matches have not been at WrestleMania, and he's about as big as they come in terms of big names. So I'd have him pretty high up on the list. I'll throw one more at you, Mick Foley. You know, I know Foley had that memorable match with Edge at WrestleMania 22, the hardcore match, which I believe was his last WrestleMania match. But if you really look at his resume, because he debuted the night after WrestleMania in 1996. And so you look at 13 and 14 was the dumpster match, 15... he came back for WrestleMania 2000 in the main event. That was not good. He was a referee for Vince and Shane at 17, which was actually, that was a great match, but technically he wasn't really, I mean, he wasn't wrestling in the match. So for a guy as big as Mankind and Foley and what he became in that company, he's got a pretty lackluster WrestleMania resume. Brad from Avondale, Arizona. Tony Chimmel, to many fans, will always be associated with Edge, with his voice crack as announcing him as the rated R superstar. Sorry. Are there any other announcer slash wrestler pairings that come to your mind the same as these two do? More recently, Samantha Irvin and Chelsea Green. And I'll throw one at you. It's not WWE. Melissa Santos and Mil Muertes in Lucha Underground. I always used to love it when she would announce Mil. Actually, she called him Mil, like he was having a meal. Mil Muertes. If you were a Lucha Underground fan, I think you know what I'm talking about. I would put that one on the list. I can't think of too many others, though. I can't think of too many others. Howard Finkel announced everybody great. I was going to say like Howard Finkel announcing Bret the Hitman Hart, but he did that for everybody. Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart, Macho Man, Randy Savage, you know, the Ultimate Warrior, The Undertaker. That's why Fink is the fucking best. We got an audio question. This one comes in from David from Essex in the UK.
Hey, Solar Monster. David from Essex in the UK. I've been a listener since 2009, and I have a question regarding Bret versus Shawn at WrestleMania 12. The match has mixed reviews. In my personal opinion, it's a bit of an overrated match. No question in regards to talent in the ring, two of my all-time favorites. But my question is, would you change anything about the match? And if so, what would that change be? Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Yeah, I would not have announced that match as an Iron Man match. And I've said that before. I think it really handicapped the two of them going into it. I think if the plan was for them to go as long as they did and not have a single fall between them, it would have been more dramatic and better if people didn't already know going into it that the match was going 60, no matter what. And if it was an Iron Man match, I would have had them trade two or three falls back and forth instead of going the entire match without a single fall. Chris from Pennsylvania, on Tuesday's TNT, you mentioned Bret Hart and how he formed the Hart Foundation, and that got me thinking about the Bloodline and how Roman formed it. Had Bret stayed in the company past 1997, do you see a scenario where they crown Stone Cold, similar to how we recently saw Cody get crowned, as champion? Cody lost at 39 and won at 40. Stone Cold lost at 13, and we know he beat Shawn at 14, but if Bret never left, could we have seen Bret losing to Austin, or would it have been a triple threat involving Shawn, but Stone Cold still wins? And do you think if Bret never did leave, how long do you think he would have lasted? Would he have worked well into the Ruthless Aggression era? Or would he have taken a back seat and wrestled once in a while like Undertaker did post-2009? Well, I think if he would have stayed there without the screw job and he would have stayed healthy, Bret could have wrestled well into the Ruthless Aggression era. And he would have been in the ring with not just Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar, but he would have been in the ring with guys like John Cena and Randy Orton and Eddie Guerrero. Like, we would have gotten a lot of great matches from him. And I've said before that if Bret stays and doesn't lose the title at Survivor Series, that Bret puts Austin over WrestleMania 14. And I don't know where you plug in Shawn Michaels. They really didn't do triple threat matches back then. Maybe they did at some of the live events. I think they started to in 97. But like triple threats and fatal four ways, I mean, they were like unicorns back then. Like you either didn't see them or they were very, very rare. So I don't know about a triple threat. I think a triple threat with Austin, Bret, and Shawn would have been great. But I always said, like, if Bret stayed, I don't think he would have had an issue at all putting over Austin at WrestleMania. Every match they ever had, Bret won. But if you look at the match that's going into the Hall of Fame this year, the submission match from WrestleMania 13, it's like Bret won, right? Technically, I mean, he won that match, but Austin got over in that match. Like, him losing in the way that he did meant so much more. But it's true, every match they ever had, the closest Austin came to beating him, he might have beaten him, I think, once by disqualification, maybe, but that's about it. And I'm sure Bret would have had no issue doing the honors for him and dropping the belt to him at WrestleMania 14, and that would have sent Austin on his way. Now, he was on his way anyway, especially after that submission match in 97. I mean, that really was like, That whole period where Bret snapped and then you had WrestleMania the following week, that right there was the kind of unofficial kickoff to the Attitude Era. Angel from Los Angeles. For many years, from 2010 as a middle schooler to 2018, turning 20 years of age, I disliked John Cena for winning so much, staying on top, and for his in-ring work. 2019 and onward, I got soft on him and started to enjoy his presence on TV. I guess I missed hating on him. I got super hyped seeing Cena versus Punk versus Roman versus Seth all in the ring at the Royal Rumble, and I smiled ear to ear when Cena and Punk went at it in the Elimination Chamber. But Cody's lines about the fans picked me, Vince picked you, you're a company creation, you've created a lot of disenfranchised fans, during their promo battle, reminded me of my critical dislike for Cena. Much like how some people these days see Jey Uso beating Gunther for the championship as stupid, I had the same mindset when the company had Cena beating all fantastic talents like
Shawn Michaels and Kurt Angle and CM Punk, Randy Orton, Brock Lesnar, Dolph Ziggler, Kevin Owens, so on and so forth, especially AJ Styles. The fact that they all can wrestle laps and laps to the moon and back around Cena, but still had to lay flat on their backs, look up at the lights, and lay for Cena had me frustrated as a kid, slash young adult, because his in-ring skills were so mid compared to those names, and they were doing and what they were doing, in my opinion. Some people got Cena up there ranked with Daniel Bryan and Bret Hart in terms of in-ring skills. I was also pissed when all the new upcoming talent immediately lost their credibility when they lost to Cena. Like Rusev, Sandow, Corbin, Ryback, The Nexus, JTG, Alex Riley, and Austin Theory. Yeah, Theory won the match, but the promo killed his push to where it didn't matter if Theory won or not. I know some of these talents I mentioned most likely would never have been top-level names, but they were all fed to Cena and never were the same again afterwards. No other John Cena feud had me more frustrated and upset than the 2014 feud with Bray Wyatt. At the time, Wyatt cut these deep, long, and dark promos. I know his promo became a bit repetitive over the years, but this was still fresh, and Wyatt could back it up in the ring and was a good wrestler. Still to this day, I still think Bray should have beaten John Cena at WrestleMania. I was heartbroken to see one of my new favorites get fed to Cena and lose his WrestleMania debut. At Extreme Rules, a kid with a ghost face voice recorder freaked Cena out and had Bray take advantage of a not clean win. And then finally at Payback, Cena literally buried Bray under the equipment to win the Last Man Standing match and the feud. And by the time it was over, I was exhausted and sick of John Cena even more. And so he goes on here about his love for Bray Wyatt and wants to know, am I too biased with my Cena dislike or is there some truth to it? Also, he says AJ losing to Cena at the Royal Rumble was bullshit. Literally could have had AJ retain, Wyatt wins the Elimination Chamber, and then could have had Bray against AJ at WrestleMania. Well, sure, yeah, you could have done Bray Wyatt against AJ Styles at WrestleMania 33, and they would have been that would have been a fine undercard match, because that's exactly where that match would have been. Although that's where Randy Orton and Bray Wyatt ended up, too. But so I don't know if you're thinking that would have been the main event, but you're out of your mind if you actually think that would have main evented the show, because it wouldn't have. Look, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that you're wrong about a lot of the frustrations that you had with John Cena, because a lot of people have expressed that frustration. And there were a lot of people who got buried in the muck. Yeah, you mentioned people like Alex Riley and Baron Corbin, and there was another name in here too. Sandow. Yeah, well, Sandow with his cash-in. Rusev, yeah, the thing with Rusev is they kept him undefeated. The whole point of Rusev, and again, that's, I just talked about Ludwig Borga, right? The evil heel foreigner, right? It's a Vince McMahon special. They kept him strong specifically so that the babyface John Cena would get the win in the end. It all built up to that WrestleMania 31 match. That was the whole point of it in the first place. I don't know that there's really a whole lot to complain about there. I mean, it's pro wrestling 101, so you could see where that was going from a mile away. But yeah, you can cherry pick other names where it's like, man, maybe they wouldn't have gone on to become world champion. Right. Or maybe they would have. But even if they didn't, it's like, man, when they lost to Cena, or they had Cena bury this guy, or Corbin with the fucking worst cash in of all time. Like, you look at that and you can find examples of guys who their careers were never the same after that. So John Cena does get a lot of hate and a lot of flack for that. But again, it's like Cena, the fact that Cena couldn't wrestle as well as an AJ Styles or a Bret Hart, you're missing the entire point. That's not why Vince McMahon picked John Cena. He didn't pick John Cena because he was the best wrestler. If Vince McMahon wanted to pick the best wrestler to be the face of his company and be his guy, then you would have had people like Dolph Ziggler, and you would have had people like, you know, Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero and guys like that, literally as the face of the company and not just as, you know, top guy underneath. Like, they would have built around them. The reason they didn't build around them is because that's not what it's about. It's not about who can wrestle the best match. It's about who can be the biggest star, who can make the most money, who could be the biggest attraction. Fucking Hulk Hogan headlined the first 8 WrestleManias, okay? WrestleMania 4, I know he wasn't technically in the main event, but of course he had to stick himself in there. Hulk Hogan was the guy that everything was built around for years and years and years. Do you think Hulk Hogan was the best wrestler in wrestling at that time? Do you think he was the best wrestler in the fucking company at that time? You mean to tell me that Hulk Hogan's in-ring work was better than the Macho Man Randy Savage or Ricky the Dragon Steamboat or some of these other people they had on the roster? No, but that's not why Vince McMahon chose him. He chose him because, oh my God, he's got the look. He's got the charisma. Look at him, the big bulging muscles, brother. 300 pounds. He's so charismatic. That's why he got pushed. In the ring, he was fine. He wasn't the best. You don't want to pick somebody who can't wrestle or who has two left feet, trips over themselves. Hogan could work. He wasn't the best, but he could work. And that's all he had to do was just be okay. He just had to be serviceable. He was pushed for all the other reasons. John Cena was pushed for all the other reasons, having nothing to do with his in-ring ability. He was charismatic. He got over with the audience. He could talk. He had that look. He was the face of the franchise. That's why he was picked. This is what some people still to this day don't understand. This is just how Vince McMahon operated. This is how this company to this day operates. Not about who the best wrestler is. Tons of great wrestlers in wrestling. It's about who they can market, who they can build their company around and make money off of. That's why Jey Uso is going to challenge for the World Heavyweight Championship at WrestleMania this year. Is Jey Uso the best wrestler? No! He's actually in the bottom tier of what they have on that roster. But there's a reason why he's in the position he's in, outside of, you know, whatever you want to say about his family connections. There's a reason why he's in the spot that he's in right now. Because the fans took to him. And he's making them a boatload of money. And so it's like, hey, we have to exploit this. We have to take advantage of this before he flames out, because this is not going to last forever. And so that's why he's challenging for the championship at WrestleMania and probably winning. Nobody is going to confuse Jey Uso as the best wrestler in any company. But it's just, you got to change the way you look at these things. I mean, you could be upset that this guy didn't get an opportunity, that guy didn't get an opportunity, but to not understand why, you know, he wasn't the best wrestler. These guys can wrestle circles around him. Like, dude, I know it sounds counterintuitive, but like, that's not what the wrestling business is about. That's not what the wrestling business has been built on for decades. Whether it was WWF or Crockett Promotions or any of these other territories, right? They went with the attraction. They went with the Crusher and they went with the Bruiser and they went with all these people who honestly were probably the shits in the ring, but there was something about them that just the fans gravitated towards them. Maybe they saw themselves in some of these guys. It's all about charisma and personalities, connecting with the audience. That will always be the number one attribute, more than any kind of holds that you know in the ring. Who gives a shit? Seriously, who cares? Sean from Queens, New York. I noticed how many title reigns are longer in length than the previous regime in WWE. I was wondering what reigns, less than half a year or so, were short but effective. I grew up with 2007 to 2010 Undertaker and was surprised to realize he did not hold the world title for longer than a few months at a time. However, his time with the belt, he was able to put over people and make it more worthwhile when he tried to get the belt back. So interesting, because we are in an era right now where we tend to have longer title reigns. I you know what? Flair in 92. Flair won the Royal Rumble. He won the championship in 1992. He lost it right away to Randy Savage. I don't recall any title defenses he had outside of that one. And I'm sure like house shows he did, but like that was a very short run, but it was very memorable. Yeah, it was very memorable. And that has to be on the list. Mankind in early 1999, I think that was done to, I don't even think it was done so much to reward Foley as much as it was done to help elevate The Rock, you know, to a higher level. Foley did for The Rock in early 99 what he did for Triple H in early 2000, where he gave him a credibility in the ring as a main eventer that maybe he didn't have before. He gave him a harder edge, right? He had that street fight with him at Madison Square Garden. Look at the matches that Foley had with Rock in early 99. Halftime Heat, I Quit match, 15 chair shots to the skull. It got Rock over like a killer. My God, this guy mauled this poor bastard. Right? He did for Rock what he did later on for Triple H. And the runs he had in early 99, they played hot potato with it. They bounced the belt back and forth, but they were very brief runs. You know, he won the title. Technically, that show was taped at the end of December. So he actually won the title in 98, even though he's credited with winning his first championship in 99. But he held the title for a few weeks, you know, and then he lost it, and then he won it back. And then a few weeks later, he lost it again. But it had an impact because I think of what it helped do for The Rock. Crash Holly, right? Maybe it's not a world championship, but Crash Holly's runs as the hardcore champion were entertaining as fuck. You know, with the 24/7 rule. Becky Lynch in 2018 on SmackDown. She only held the title for, what was it, three or four months? But think about what she did in that time, right? This is when we first saw the man. Think about what she did in that time. She had a match of the year contender against Charlotte Flair at the first Evolution pay-per-view, last woman standing. And also what I remember to be a great TLC match with Charlotte and Asuka. I love that match. And they main evented that pay-per-view with it. Good questions. Keep them rolling in, thesolemonster@gmail.com. And I'm going to be live with you again tonight. There's a second podcast coming your way immediately after AEW Dynasty on YouTube. I'll be there for the full post-show review, talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly. Hopefully not a lot of ugly. Hopefully more good than bad, which is usually the case with their pay-per-views, but we all know how that ending of Revolution went. That went over like a fart in church. But we'll talk about that later tonight, and of course I'll be live on the YouTube channel this week after Raw, after Dynamite, and then again after SmackDown on Friday night. You can find me over on JD's channel. We do Tuesday Night Titans every Tuesday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We've been killing that lately as well, so plenty of content for you to check out. Thank you for all the love and support. Let's carry that over into this week. Let's carry it over into next Sunday when I'm going to be back with you for episode 909. Mean Gene Okerlund would be proud. 909. Let's see how many of you get that reference. That'll be coming up next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, and I will see you back here very soon for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Swerve begins to walk down the hallway, and all of a sudden, who bursts through the doors off in the background? Hangman Adam Page comes charging in. He says Swerve is wasting his time because he made a promise long time ago that Swerve Strickland would never hold the AEW World Championship ever again. He's not going to let this go. This man is still obsessed. Hangman screams that you broke into my house. Swerve screams back at him, you burned my house down. So Hangman screamed, you deserved it. And then Swerve, you're right, I deserved it. God, I fucking love pro wrestling. Like, it's just so fucking absurd. But I love it. How can you not love this shit?
The Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solomonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solomonster.
I love you so long.